Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
My definition of justice and yours is totally different. On top of that, February 20th, 2016, there was massive rallies nationwide saying injustice, injustice. Peter Liang was not a scapegoat. Peter Liang is part of the problem. Every last one of those Asians and Chinese supporters, because you are also part of the problem, you helped back and finance. You understand? You guys got together. And here it is. You're saying it's okay. When I walked downtown Brooklyn February 20th, I was called a nigger. Do you understand? After giving solidarity to the family, the family's there in the flesh, I was disrespected. So it's no way you can tell me we are all people of color.
You know, this is the testament to how our communities can come together to address something larger. We will never know, as Asian Americans, what it's like to lose a life every 28 hours, like the black community does in the United States. And what I do want to raise is that when we talk about structural racism, white supremacy, and anti-blackness, we have to admit that Asian Americans are complicit and complacent to uphold white supremacy. And we are responsible in making sure that we stand together with black communities to bring down white supremacy and structural racism. That's the only way to win for all of us. All of our lives will matter when black lives matter. All of our lives will matter when black lives matter. Black lives matter.
We are all people of color.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, June 14th, 2016. So I have been told we should be here on Thursday. I can give the reminder this time. We'll be doing workplace racism. We have moved that segment to Thursdays, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I had suggested 2 weeks ago that people go through their policy and procedure for their respective jobs, your respective employers, and pick out one piece, one regulation, one rule, one policy that you think is relevant, either something that you did not know. It can be a regulation that is flaunted regularly in terms of people not following it or it being enforced in a haphazard manner. If it's a piece of policy that you think allows for discretion in terms of there might not be just enforcement. Sometimes they enforce it. Sometimes they don't. This could be something if they choose to fire an employee. This could be a means of doing so. We just take a piece of policy, as I said, where it's not uniformly enforced. Anything that you think is stands out from your policy and procedure, just share one thing on the Thursday workplace racism discussion. Make sure I give out our reminder because we might be on tomorrow, we might not. So that way you'll have at least one heads up before we get to the Thursday broadcast. At any rate, we should have time to discuss either today or as we move forward this week, the shooting that happened down in Florida, extremely important event with lots of ramifications, not just for our understanding of racism, white supremacy, but I think it will have a huge impact on the presidential election, what happens, how things play out coming up in November. But we'll have time to discuss that as well. And I have an update from our broadcast that we had yesterday with Christopher Clark, the suspected racist in South Africa. It was an early broadcast. I know a lot of folks were not able to listen to the live program because it was on significantly earlier than our typical broadcast time. But I do have an update to share from that as well. At any rate, broadcast for today, I played a segment a few weeks back earlier this year talking about the shooting case of Akai Gurley, unarmed 28-year-old black male in New York. This was at the end of 2014. It was right after all of the furor around the shooting death of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, Miriam Carey. In New York, black male, he was shot in the Pink housing project. He was shot by an NYPD officer, Peter Liang, non-white male, Chinese-American, shot and killed. They say it was an accident. He heard a noise in the stairwell. This case has garnered a lot of attention, not as much as it should have, but a lot of attention over the past, I guess, year and a half at this point. Peter Liang was fired from the NYPD. He was ultimately convicted of manslaughter. And eventually this year, just a few months back, he was not sentenced to jail time for the killing of Akai Gurley. There were massive protests across the country where many non-white people, Asian Americans, were protesting and saying that they did not think this was just, that they did not think Peter Liang should have been sentenced. They thought that he was being, quote unquote, scapegoated, that if he had been a white NYPD officer, he would not have been indicted in the first place, that there were so many other incidents of white officers killing and brutalizing black citizens and nothing happened to them, that they thought it was an act of racism that he was being punished to begin with in something that they regarded as a tragic accident. Many black people have been upset about this, even upset at the prosecutor, Ken Thompson, who is a black male, that he suggested, recommended no jail time for Peter Liang, even after he got the conviction against Mr. Liang. The audio clip you heard at the beginning of the program featured our guest for today's broadcast, as well as the aunt of Akai Gurley, Hortensia Peterson. They were on Democracy Now! Earlier this year. They were talking about this case and what it reveals about white supremacy. When I played that segment before, I thought it would be great to have her on the program just to talk about some of the dynamics that this case reveals about white supremacy, and particularly the role of non-white, non-black people within this case and within the larger structure of white supremacy. Our guest joining us live, she is the executive director of CAAAV. They do a lot of grassroots organizing to help Asian American immigrants in housing and workplace situations. You can go visit their website. It should be linked in the description to the program. It's CAAAV.org. Again, CAAAV.org. Real pleasure to have her on the program joining us live, Ms. Kathy Dang. Ms. Dang, I was looking for your name, but I'm not seeing it amongst our numbers. If you could press *6, then I can pick out which line you are on, *6, and then I think you'll get a prompt to press the number 1, and then I can pick out which line is actually you. I was thinking your name was going to show up, but I'm not seeing your name. So if you're with us, Ms. Dang, just press *6 and then the number 1, and I'll be able to get your line. Let's see. Ms. Dang, do we have you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for visiting us on the program. Great to have you. For our listeners, anything that you would like to share with us about the work that you do and the work of CAAAV?
Yes. So, again, thank you for having me to have this conversation. And I think it's such a critical time in our history when we talk about racial justice and white supremacy. CAAAV started in the 80s after the killing of Vincent Chin, who was a Chinese-American in Detroit, Michigan, killed by a white father and son. And the white father and son never served one day in jail. And this case actually triggered organizing across the country in Asian American communities, particularly the Chinese American community. And CAF started out of that. In the 80s and 90s, there was a spike of hate and police violence impacting Asian immigrants and refugees. And CAF responded to all those individual cases and hate violence cases. But we soon realized that we couldn't just keep organizing on individual cases. We had to organize on the root causes of violence. And having a strong analysis on what it means to fight capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, and using our projects around worker organizing, housing organizing to address the root causes of violence and violence in all its different forms. And we've, since our history, have supported, if it's not people within our own communities, but stood in solidarity with Black and Latino, queer and trans people who've been impacted by police violence.
Outstanding. If folks, longtime listeners to the CAFS will remember, we talked about the case with Vincent Chin, with Frank Wu way, way back, 2009. He was on the program, extremely important case that reveals quite a bit about racism, white supremacy. There was a little bit of distortion in your line. I'm not sure what's causing it.
Let me try this. Is this better?
I guess give us another sentence, if you would.
Is this working better for you? Do you hear me?
That sounds much clearer. I think we should be okay with
okay.
that. Outstanding.
All right.
For folks who have not seen you, you are Asian American. Is that how you classify yourself?
I am. I am Asian American. I identify as Southeast Asian. I'm Chinese Vietnamese. My parents are from Vietnam, so I come from the experience of war and trauma and the refugee resettlement in the U.S.
Wow. Okay. And are you in the New York area? Is that correct?
Yes, I was raised in Ridgewood, Queens, and moved around in New York. You know, much of my experience also was in downtown Brooklyn during the 80s and 90s, and moved to Los Angeles. So I consider my bicoastal to LA and New York, and have been organizing in both cities for over 11, 12 years now.
Okay. Outstanding. We have a lot of New York listeners and, you know, folks that have been following not just the case with Akai Gurley and Peter Liang, but certainly Eric Garner and some of the other major incidents that have been happening in New York
Definitely.
Over the past few decades. This program, we always start off with my definition for racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms, white supremacy, racism. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
That definition is definitely accurate, and it's really clear how that's used to divide and conquer. And with the case that we you know, with the Kai Gurley case in particular, and in the last couple of years in recent history in New York City, what we've seen with white officers not being held accountable whatsoever, not even being indicted, shows that it's being the Kai Gurley case was one way for the system to divide communities in New York City. You know, but we do have a particular outlook on the case. You know, reality is, at the end of the day, Peter Liang is a cop. And what happened in the end was him not even serving jail time. Obviously, he is receiving cop privilege and the benefits of white privilege of being a cop. You know, it's tough because the way we saw it before the indictment happened, you know, Ken Thompson, the DA, was one of the few district attorneys in New York City who came into office with this commitment to restoring the people's faith in the justice system. And he was one of the few DAs who prosecuted cops in the past, who indicted landlords for abusive practices of harassment and living conditions of the tenants. So we had faith in Ken Thompson to do the right thing. Whereas the other DAs in the Bronx and Staten Island, like Dan Pantaleo's case, Don Donovan, the DA there, didn't do anything about Dan Pantaleo. You know, we saw the larger system at play, with the DAs also not being in sync and being held accountable for doing the job and making sure that officers are held accountable. So, yes, what you have described as racism and white supremacy is definitely the definition that I wholeheartedly believe in. But at the same time, you know, we see how the system came to play and how it worked and how it functioned with the district attorney's office, the NYPD, and then people in New York. And, you know, what Audre Lorde says is divide and conquer must become defined and empower, and that is what CAV is rooted in. Historically, have always stood side by side by other communities of color and queer and trans communities to make sure that we stand together to uphold the principles and values of pushing change within a system. And we don't let the system divide us.
Right on. For folks who are curious, CAV stands for Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence, CAV, C-A-A-A-V. And she was mentioning Daniel Pantaleo. That's the officer, one of the officers that was present for the choking death of Eric Garner that also happened in 2014 that we mentioned. Before we get into some of the more details of what happened with Akai Gurley, Peter Liang, certainly there's been a lot of focus on the massive terrorist attack down in Orlando, Florida. You all had Twitter post about that as well, officially from CAV. What are your thoughts, Ms. Dang, on that event that took place this past weekend?
Yeah, please call me Kathy, it's fine.
Okay.
I haven't been sleeping. I think one is keeping in mind the pain the family members are going through, beyond what's a news story, beyond what the outrages across the country and the sadness and frustration. I think what we should keep in mind first and foremost is the pain of the family members. I just cannot imagine what they're going through. No one really can. To see your family member on the news and to hear that you've lost a loved one through the news, to be contacted in such a horrific way. And it's that it's our experience working with the family of Akai Gurley and our allies, the justice community in New York City, who's worked with dozens of families over the last 30-something years, where we really want to shed light on what the families are experiencing and making sure that they're at the forefront of what the changes that we want to see. And that's first. And then I think, secondly, it's just baffling, I think, how the media is portraying everything. Like, one, it's the media saying it's a hate crime against LGBTs across the country, but not acknowledging that these are actually queer and trans Latinx people whose lives were stolen by the murderer. And I think that's what needs to be also focused and highlighted. And when we talk about violence against queer and trans people, we have to acknowledge that it's queer and trans people of color, Latinos and Blacks, who are the most impacted first, who are attacked on the street, who are discriminated when it comes to housing. That is separate from what white queer and trans people are experiencing. And so we see the media whitewashing, and we want to make sure that in all of our cities, when we have these values and rituals, that we really make sure that they're on the forefront sharing their pain and their struggle and their stories and frustrations and how they're one place of sanctuary and safety. The queer and trans club or gay club was the one place where they felt free and felt safe, but that's not even the case anymore. But definitely, I think how CAV has in the past and still today do our work is making sure that the people on the forefront who are experiencing the most pain and frustration should be the first people speaking and responding and giving us direction.
Right on. I have seen a lot of commentary worldwide. BB, I've been trying to check some of the international outlets to see how they've been talking about this, and the vast majority of outlets that I have seen, they have kind of centered this as an attack on gay and the LGBTQ community with what happened, mm-hmm. and going to people in different LGBT communities around the country and around the world to get their thoughts on this. What I have not seen, the absence that you mentioned, is that the photos that I started to see of the victims, it looked like a lot of non-white people. The reports that I've seen, I think this was Latin night at the club. It looked like a lot of these people would be classified as not white, and I have not seen any real focus on that at all. That's something that I think is extremely important in all of this. I think, as you said, the whitewashing of how this event is covered that white people who classify as gay or lesbian or queer or transgender, they have a radically different experience than non-white people who are lesbian, gay, transgender, what have you, in a global system of white supremacy. I think that's a huge aspect of this that has been woefully underrepresented in the coverage.
And it was Puerto Rican Day weekend. it happened on Puerto Rican Day weekend, and the majority of the people who were killed were Puerto Rican.
Right.
In Orlando, and so when we took a deeper look at that, you know, I don't think any media outlet has mentioned that it was Puerto Rican Day weekend. So that's just the other thing. I think the other piece of it is how it's covered around the shooter, Omar Mateen, and how, you know, it's pictured as, it's portrayed as if, you know, he made this commitment to ISIS, which I think is complete BS and made up and fabricated by the media, to continue to fuel this war around the globe, but particularly in Muslim countries. And it, you know, when you do the research and look into the story, it's obvious that he's an American-born homophobe, and it's not that he's a quote-unquote terrorist that's come into this country and terrorizing people. And, you know, it's funny because elected officials want to jump on this now and speak onto the issues about justice for queer people, but are the same exact people who passed legislation making it difficult and oppressing the lives of queer and trans people across the country.
Wow. Very important. And that I just heard that literally like minutes before we went on live, that about half of the fatalities in this case, that they were Puerto Ricans, which you shared about it being a Puerto Rican Day celebration that they were having as well in conjunction with all of this. We'll certainly be talking about this more on the program as we move forward in the coming days and weeks as more information comes out, but certainly wanted to get your thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. Just before I get to the Peter Liang case, I've also been trying to ask many of our guests that come on the program, what are some of the, if they're books or even if they're films, other resources that were really fundamental in shaping your interest and understanding mm-hmm. of white supremacy?
Mm-hmm. You know, initially, I was actually an Asian American Studies major, sociology major, Asian American Studies minor, women's studies minor. And I started off reading a lot of the books about the Asian American identity, which I think has, when we talk about race and Asian American identity today, it's much different from what I read and learned and how I identified myself over 10 years ago when I started reading these books. And I actually took a lot of classes in African American Studies, and Dion Bennett, who currently teaches in New York, was one of my mentors who brought me W. Du Bois and Gloria Anzaldúa and bell hooks, and it was my diversity and my different readings from Asian American studies to Chicano studies to African American studies that shaped my understanding of the larger picture. But I think, you know, for a lot of Asian American activists and organizers today, when we talk about our Asian American identity from over 10 years ago when we started in college, it's much different than it is today, because back then, it was about everything about us being Asian, anything that's targeting us Asians. Now we have to push for a larger narrative and conversation about centering the struggle and centering the fight around a larger picture and centering the people who are most directly impacted by the system. When we talk about education, when we talk about the prison industrial complex, when we talk about housing and access to housing. So it's an array of different things that I've read, from bell hooks and W. Du Bois to Gloria Anzaldúa to Yuri Kochiyama. But I think ultimately we can't really learn everything from books and from theories. It's about the struggle and pain that we've gone through in life to help to shape our understanding. So my parents don't really understand and continue to not understand why I'm in the fight and why I'm in the movement. And I tell my mom, you know, for you as a woman who's been in prison for trying to leave Vietnam, who's lived through war, come to the U.S. and worked in nail salons to raise me and my sister in working class neighborhoods, you dealing with racism and sexism and patriarchy and capitalism, it really is the raw experience and pain that helps shape my understanding. So what I would say is for people to dig deep in understanding our emotions and our raw pain, because it's that pain that helps us build our resilience and understanding the larger context of why we fight.
Right on. What, I guess this is kind of a two-parter, if you can describe, because I think you all have on the website that a lot of what influenced the history of CAV, and you all just celebrated your 30-year anniversary of the work that you've mm-hmm. been doing, Peter Yu and Kang Wong, that you all were doing activist mm-hmm. work to support these victims, if you could describe mm-hmm. some just who these folks are, what you all were doing, and then also, is it accurate that you all got a lot of black support in supporting these two victims?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Peter Yu was actually before time. That was in the 70s. And it was Yoshin Huang in 95 who was 16 years old at the time, killed by an NYPD officer in Brooklyn. That was one of the really high-profile cases in New York because it was right around that same time as Anthony Baez, Hilton Vega, Nicholas Hayward, when they were all killed in New York. And shortly after, a couple years after that, I believe, LaShawn Bell. And when we organized to support the family of Yoshin, it was his sisters and his mother who took over the district attorney's office and did a sit-in and got arrested. But they did it alongside with the family of Hilton Vega, Anthony Baez, and Nicholas Hayward. And so to this day, you know, when we go around and see the families again, they ask about each other, how's Yoshin's sister doing? How's Joyce doing? How's Yoshin's mom doing? Back in the 90s, and in the 90s and mid-90s, 96, when we were organizing, it actually was Black and Latino families who came out first to support the family of Yoshin Huang, asking how they can show solidarity, but also asking what can we do together to fight to make sure there's a large system of change that we want with NYPD, and back then with Mayor Giuliani. And, you know, with Kang Wong, that was, I believe, 2013, he was an elderly Chinese immigrant from Cuba who was allegedly jaywalking and didn't understand any English, and the cops stopped him and asked for an ID, tried to give him a ticket, but there was some ruffle, and they ended up brutalizing Mr. Wong, who was a senior citizen at that time, who was much older. And, you know, they tried to charge him with disorderly conduct and a whole bunch of other bogus charges. And, you know, the Asian Americans were... community in New York City responded and organized around the case, and it was because CAV works so closely with so many Black and Latino organizations, they came out first to say, what can we do to support Mr. Wong? He was a senior immigrant, didn't speak any English. It's totally unfair and wrong for that cop to do that. And they came to the court to demand the charges be dropped against Mr. Wong. They came and wrote letters and reposted our stuff all over social media to make sure that the story was spread throughout New York and within their base and their reach. And they continued to follow up. And there was two appearances at court, and we both showed up to it. And we had dozens of people who were rallying around Mr. Wong. So from the 90s till now, it's a lot of the organizations that we work with and are rooted from since the 80s that we've been working alongside with who've continued to work with us around larger analysis on a larger system, whether it be from police accountability to its connection, police being used as a tool for housing displacement and gentrification to economic disparities. It's across the board. All of our organizations work on different issues, impacting communities of color in New York. And, we've made sure that we put out a framework of a larger analysis of how everything's interplayed with each other.
With the Peter Liang case, former NYPD officer who shot and killed Akai Gurley in 2014, how would you respond to those who say that, you know, this case has nothing to do with racism, white supremacy? Akai Gurley was not shot by a white enforcement officer. Peter Liang was not convicted by a white judge. The judge in the case was Danny Chun, who's an Asian American. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutor in the case was a black male, Ken Thompson, that this has nothing to do with white supremacy.
That's interesting. I've actually never heard that has nothing to do with white supremacy. If anything, in New York, what we've been hearing is it's everything that has to do with white supremacy. And I think what's bizarre is that even on the flip side of it, Liang supporters were using our same language and same analysis to support their argument and for the reason why Liang shouldn't be held accountable and that he's a victim of white supremacy, too. It's actually, I've never heard that. I haven't heard that. I've heard actually quite the opposite, and I was baffled that Liang supporters were able to use our same theory and apply it to why Liang should not be held accountable. But at the end of the day, Peter Liang was not a victim. He did do something wrong. He was indicted for second-degree manslaughter and was convicted for second-degree manslaughter. And any average civilian who does the same exact crime would go to jail. But an officer should not be treated any differently from an average civilian who's out there on the street, particularly Black and Latino people in New York City who are charged and indicted and convicted with the same crimes. The criminal justice system and at play, like this case with the Kaguli is even so clearly evident how white supremacy works and functions. So I haven't heard that. I think that's interesting that you're saying that. And I think with Ken Thompson and Judge Denny Chen, who's Korean American, and Ken Thompson, who's black, it actually goes to show how even people of color, black, Latino, and Asian, who work within the system, doesn't necessarily mean that your interests are represented. Representation does not equal power. And that was clearly it. People thought that because Ken Thompson because Ken Thompson was in office as a district attorney, that there would be some possibility of some level of real accountability. But it's even more clear that when we should not let and cannot let identity politics come into play. And that is what hurt our work, I think, in any of our organizing. But identity politics came to really help the land supporters to get what they wanted.
Just for our listeners, when you say identity politics helped LANG supporters get what they wanted, what do you mean specifically?
Yeah, so, I see this in particular with non-black, maybe some like white Jewish communities, but particularly I would say like Latino and Asian, some particular communities like Vietnamese, Cuban, Chinese, where they use their ethnicity and identity and nationalism from their homeland and what they experience as a reason why people need to stand together. But it's definitely a real big issue with the Chinese community in the U.S., across the country, where they use that as a reason why they need to stand together. Even when Chinese people are the biggest oppressors of other Chinese people. So, for example, some of the biggest exploiters of Chinese working-class immigrants or Chinese people are other Chinese wealthy conservatives who will use them at the Chinese immigrants and working-class immigrants at their own dispense. So, employers at restaurants and laundromats and caretakers who are employed by their employers, when you look at how little they get paid sometimes, $2-3 an hour, restaurant delivery people make $2-3 an hour, and their employers are other Chinese wealthy conservatives. So it's identity politics when they use their identity as Chinese people and coming to the U.S. and struggling as Chinese immigrants, but their experience is far different from each other. When we talk to our tenants in Chinatown about what they experience with NYPD, a lot of them also say they don't like them because they often are used to bring in to displace them. So if there's a vacate order in Chinatown, the city will call the cops to come and vacate the building, and if they don't leave, they get arrested. And, the identity politics, this is why we have to make sure when we do education and flow of education, when we organize, it's a really clear class analysis in capitalism, because it's the elite, and the police are used as a tool to protect the elite. And that's how we frame it with our immigrant members to make sure that we're able to build a bridge between their struggle and the black struggle and the Latino struggle and the queer and trans struggle.
What's your response to those who have heavily criticized Prosecutor Ken Thompson? He recommended no jail time, which is ultimately the sentence that Peter Liang received. He's a black male, and saying, that he really did a poor job with this case, even though he did get the conviction. And Ken, just again, I think it's important to point out, Ken Thompson also was a part of the prosecuting team that did get a conviction for the NYPD officer, Justin Volpe, who sodomized Abner Luena some years ago. Yeah. He was also part of the prosecuting team for Napisatu Diallo, the black female worker who was sexually abused by Dominic Strauss-Kahn. I think that was 2011. He also is a big part of his campaign as a prosecuting attorney in Brooklyn is wrongful convictions, where he's got a lot of individuals, a lot of them non-white people, who were wrongly convicted and locked up and serving big sentences. He got a lot of them out of jail, but a lot of people were big time disappointed and upset with Ken Thompson. How do you respond to that?
Politics and what they really are concerned about is their election. Across the board, you see, I do want to make a note of the other people who came out in support of Liang, who came out running for office immediately after he wasn't served any jail time, but with Ken Thompson, you know, we had faith. A lot of us really had faith and thought there was a real possibility of accountability in Liang serving jail time. So the two ADAs who prosecuted the case was ADA Joe Alexis and Mark Fleedner. And Mark Fleedner, who's a white man, and Joe Alexis, who's a black man, and definitely taking orders from Ken Thompson, who was more concerned about his re-election. You know, I think it was the day that he recommended no jail time. I was actually in a meeting with him and a bunch of other people, clergy and people who ran Chinese organizations in South Brooklyn. It was actually very surprising. And it was really clear that he was more concerned about his re-election and his political career than it was about real justice. And it's no coincidence that shortly after, a month after, Mark Fleener resigned. He was the lead ADA on the case. Joe Alexis is still there. It's Mark Fleener and a whole bunch of other of his ADAs and staff and communications people who've left Ken Thompson's office. So it's pretty evident that he's failing as a DA what he took oath to do when he came into office. And he is like any other politician, an elected candidate who's trying to run for office.
Do you think, I know some of our New York listeners have said that they think him being in that position, he is very dependent on cooperation from other NYPD officers, many of them white, that they could have directly or indirectly applied pressure to him to say, hey, you had better not come out thinking that you're going to sentence this guy. If you do, we might not be as cooperative with you moving forward in future cases. Do you think that's possible?
That is a possibility, but I also, you know, we didn't really see the Police Benevolent Association, the police union, show up to much of the court during trial. And I think also in part of their racist values that didn't support Liang because he was a non-white cop. I think it's partially the Chinese immigrants and people in Brooklyn organizing around him to support the non-accountability of Liang. At the end of the day, I think he was just really concerned about his political career, and not so much about the cops coming forward and supporting for other cases. Because Renee, actually, more recently, I would say 2 weeks ago, I don't know if you saw the story, but an officer who was indicted before Liang was convicted and is serving a couple of months of jail time for stomping on a Brooklyn resident's head, I believe. And so he's actually serving a couple months of jail time, more jail time than Peter Liang. It's a mixed bag. You know, he has a long history of holding other cops accountable, but in this particular case, he didn't follow through. I question that.
What's your response to those who say if Peter Liang had been white, this would have never even got to trial, much less conviction?
It's unclear now. I think it's hard to say now because at the end, Ken Thompson ended up doing the same exact thing, referring to the case of Brian Cronin, who killed a African immigrant in Chelsea. It's really hard to say. I think if people didn't actually organize around this particular case, I don't know if he would not went to jail. I think Liang, there might have been a chance that Liang actually went to jail. there was a political momentum building up before the indictment of Liang that led to his indictment. It was, we're organizing throughout New York City from 2014, from Trayvon Martin all the way until the end of 2014, 2015, but the non-assignment of Dan Pantaleo for the murder of Eric Garner. And it's that political momentum that ensured an indictment of the next officer that came down the line, and it just so happened that it was Peter Liang.
That's interesting. I think you already responded to this. I just wanted to make sure. Peter Liang, is he a victim in this case as a non-white male who gets prosecuted for this, who may have been treated differently if he had been white? Is he a victim also of racism?
He may have been treated differently, but he's definitely not a victim. He is not a scapegoat. A scapegoat is someone who didn't do anything wrong, and in this case, he did do something wrong. He was indicted and convicted of second-degree manslaughter, and like any other person who does that crime would go to jail, and he should too. And, you know, him serving 800 hours of community service, and we hear actually within our community that his attorneys were trying to call a bunch of Asian American organizations so they could do his community service hours there. It's pitiful. It's just a disgrace. And he ended up, I think, ultimately going to do his hours at a senior citizen center somewhere in Brooklyn.
Wow. I had not heard that part about people offering to pitch in to help with his community service. That's, as you said, disgraceful. What's your response, and particularly with that added on, what's your response to black people who say, hey, there were numerous reports for months and months and months throughout this case of Asian Americans across the country, not just in New York, who were protesting and supporting Peter Lang, and I mean coming out in the thousands and saying that this is ridiculous and you cannot punish this officer for an accident, and they had huge big signs saying they're two victims. What's your response to black people who say that, hey, I have not seen any level of Asian support for any number of black people, Sandra Bland, Miriam Carey, Eric Garner. I've seen nothing of the sort in terms of coming out to support black people for what we've experienced.
Yeah, that's one of the probably one of the most important things that I do want to share. And one is that there's a new wave of wealth coming into this country from Asia, particularly China and India, some from Korea, where it's actually wealthy Chinese immigrants who come from very privileged experiences and backgrounds, class background, and coming to the U.S. and using and manipulating the working class immigrant community to their advantage, using our base for their own political agenda. So when we work with grassroots groups across the country, and we mapped it out, who are the people behind the Liang rallies? So when we mapped it out in New York City, these are the same people who ran for office and failed before. Phil Jim, Doug Lee, Don Lee, and now others who stepped up, Gigi Lee, Yulin Niu, Youngman League, running against Congresswoman Nydia Velasquez. These are people who have their own political agenda, who come from wealth, who come from a more privileged background. And then we mapped it out to see that in San Francisco, the same people who supported Liang are the same people who are fighting rent control in San Francisco, trying to kill rent control. And these are Chinese Americans who are trying to kill rent control in San Francisco for their own wealth and gain. And the same people who organized around that also are the same people who are trying to kill affirmative action in California, and also kill a bill that would disaggregate data in Asian, Pacific, and other communities, which would help Southeast Asians and Pacific Islanders. So we look across the country. Well, you know, our communities are not monolithic. It's a particular group of people who are manipulating the working class based on their own political agenda. But it is a responsibility of working class people to be able to decipher and understand that they're being manipulated. And so that's why, I comment on how it's our responsibility to address the complacency and complicity of our communities around white supremacy. I think the second thing is that, you know, I think someone had made a comment about, you know, they were sad to see where people are today in the Asian American community. And that when you look at the 60s and the 70s, it was our communities who fought alongside and following the leadership of black communities around education and immigration reform and workers' rights. You know, we've come a much different direction from where we were 40, 50 years ago. And when we talk to people in our community, those organizations, people who have been rooted in the U.S. much longer, definitely say that Liang needs to be held accountable. It's a new wave of wealth that's coming from Asia that's doing this and using our own working class people for their own political and capital gain.
That what you just said, I think this gets to some of the question I wanted to make sure I ask. But when you were on Democracy Now!, you said that Asian Americans are complicit and complacent to uphold white supremacy. Just if you could give a bit more detail about how so.
Sure, yeah. You know, I think where I came with that is, you know, we come from at CAV an understanding that we have the collective responsibility for collective liberation. And I'll say that again, we have a collective responsibility for collective liberation. And we in our own communities need to call out the other people in our own communities are doing wrong and hurting even people within our own community. And when we can't see, and we need to do the education with our base and our membership base and immigrant members to see that if there are not policies, you know, when we say all lives matter, when black lives matter, it's because the way that the system and the foundation in the U.S. is set up, if there's not a policy that we address that's impacting specifically Black communities, it will, if Black communities do not exist in the U.S., it will be another community, and there will be Asians who are impacted by the policies. And so, you know, it's a lot of work that we have to do, but it's calling in. You know, I think, you know, organizers then were doing a lot of calling out, but what we're doing at CAP, we want to call in. We're building the left and immigrant community because we want to make sure that they're no longer complicit and complacent with white supremacy. Like, where we are now is a new wave of wealth from Asia coming into the U.S. doing just that. And we have the responsibility as Asian Americans today to make sure that they don't continue doing that for their own gain.
Again, context of white supremacy, our guest, the executive director of CAV, Ms. Kathy Dang. As an Asian American, are there ways that you personally have been complicit in upholding white supremacy?
Yeah, I saw that question. I gave it some thought, and I'm pretty sure throughout my life there has been. You know, I've been able to access higher education and been able to get a job, you know, and I accepted the job, and working at unions and you know, they're different. It's still social justice work, but, you know, there's still racist tendencies in some work, even the social justice movement. So in that way, I've benefited from the model minority myth. The perceptions that we are, the Asians are better at certain things. Like, we reap the benefits of it, and I think it's hard for a lot of people to admit that. But, you know, I think today it's a different conversation with CAV and a bunch of grassroots groups across the country that organize in Asian immigrant communities. It's about understanding and acknowledging the benefits that we get from it, but also tackling it and making sure that we're not the people, just the people receiving the benefits, that we have to make sure that we address the root causes. And in order to do that, we have to make sure we fight the policies and the violence that happens in Black communities every day.
There was a segment, this was on NPR, this was actually last year, so this was way before we got to the trial, conviction, all of that, but they had been talking about this case for a long time. So this was 2015, almost a year ago, where they had Asian commenters, and they basically took a position that was very different from the position that you've taken, and saying that they do not agree, they do not think that Black people are subjected to worse or more intense levels of white supremacy, and that they think Asian people are treated way worse in this part of the world, that Black people are in a much more powerful position than Asians. I wanted to play the clip and get your response. So this is from NPR about May of 2015.
Stop this! Stop this! Last month, hundreds of protesters walked across the Brooklyn Bridge calling for a fair trial. Tom Lai of Queens pointed to Officer Liang's lack of experience at 27 and with less than 18 months on the job.
He's a rookie. I'm not defending him because I don't know what police procedures are, but I mean, if you're a rookie, how would you react?
Lai sees a connection between Liang's indictment and the lack of one after the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
They're looking for a scapegoat, and they say, this Asian guy, this community don't vote, they don't have enough elected official, they don't know what to say, let's get them.
And Queens resident Jin Cheng agreed.
Mr. Peter Liang won't be charged if he's a white policeman. It's demonstrating the other incident, like one in Ferguson.
Cheng said the NYPD disciplining or even firing Liang would be understandable, but indicting him on criminal charges, he said, is purely racist and politically motivated.
In America, people say, well, white people is a first class, Black people is a second class. What I see Chinese is no class or the last class. So we have to change that.
Context of white supremacy, Chinese Americans last class in America. What are your thoughts on that segment?
Yeah, I do want to make note of how they're all men speaking, or what I perceive to hear that there are men, and how patriarchy comes to play with white supremacy and capitalism, and how they're so interconnected, and the people leading behind all of their rallies have been men. And it's you know, people stepping, it's how the whole system works of, you know, white men and white women who support white men, and like Hillary who gets up there. But with the last comment of what he had said, you know, It's a sentiment of the immigrants today coming into the U.S. that they have their last class or no class. I've heard it before, and it's education that work we have to do with our base around what that means and understanding that they are here because of the Black struggle that made way for our work around immigration, the Immigration Act, so that they could come to the U.S. They don't know that context. And, of course, the people who disseminate the information will disseminate information that benefits them. And it's really disappointing that, this is the message that's getting around. And the Chinese media actually doesn't really help. And there's a group that started in New York that came out of CAV, and there are people who worked with us, but we, thought it was more important to start more groups. But they had, a couple of weeks ago, protested Tsing Tao, one of the ethnic Chinese media in New York City, and they're actually national, and there's a handful of Chinese ethnic media, and they control the narrative and message of what gets out there and what gets disseminated. And that is what they're seeing. In the papers, that is what they're reading, and that is their form of political education, which is not okay. And that's why groups like CAV or groups like DREM that organize South Asians in Jackson Heights, or Chinese Progressive Association in San Francisco, it's even more the reason why our organizations are important. Is to make sure that the media isn't the only source putting that message out, and they don't twist what the real narrative is. But a lot of newer immigrants feel that way because they don't see themselves represented. And the one face that they do see is a cop that's being charged, indicted, and convicted when other white cops weren't. That's what they're seeing in the media. And the media has such a huge control on how they experience the U.S.
Hmm. Were you, I played the audio clip at the beginning of the program. Hortensia Peterson, that's Akai Gurley's aunt, she said that she was at a rally in February of this year where she was called a nigger by some of Peter Liang's supporters. Were you at that rally?
No, I was not at that rally because Liang's supporters had put out my home address and my family's names and my personal information on a public forum. So there were safety concerns for me to be at that rally. I know people who went, and they reported back to me what happened. And it was really upsetting. I think we take responsibility as a community, CAV, for what Liang people are doing. It's wrong. It's racist. And I think what's even more hurtful is what Aunt T had mentioned was they did this whole condolences for the family stuff in the beginning, and then start saying, two victims, one tragedy, and Liang shouldn't be held accountable or go to jail or be prosecuted. And it's just disgusting. And I think when I talk about Asian American studies from 10 years and the conversations around race, the conversation around race in the U.S. is much different. It's a different discourse that we have today than we did 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Wow. You were facing backlash from other Asian Americans for your work in this case, like them putting out your personal information and what have you?
Yeah, my whole organization did, but specifically me. They had put out one of our staff cell phone number on a national call list. We were on a receiving hate emails, mail to the office, phone calls, people coming into the office. I think it was a real challenge for my staff and our volunteers and my board members to go through all of that. But we came out. I think it's really taken a toll, but I think it's helped shape our understanding today of what we need to do in movement building. So other Asian organizations said, CAV shouldn't be the only organization that bears the brunt of all this backlash. It's our whole responsibility across the U.S., to make sure their names are out there. So it's a learning moment. It's definitely a learning moment for us in our organizing, because it wasn't just CAB. There are many Asian organizations who were standing up for the family of Akai Gurley and across the country, organizing around Mario Woods in California, and for the accountability of Dan Pantaleo. People were organized across the country all this time from our own Asian communities. A lot of us went to Ferguson, but I think a lot of them leaned on CAV to be on the forefront because we were here in New York. So our learning moment is that we have to create more organizations to support and foster the more organizations to do this work. And it can't be just this 30-year-old organization who has a history of this. Like, we need to birth new leadership around this work.
Wow. What, just with what you experienced personally and your organization in general, and certainly what we heard from Ms. Hortensia Peterson about, being called a nigger while she was out at this rally. What does that suggest about possibilities for all non-white people unifying, people of color, as they say, unifying against white supremacy at this point, 2016?
Yeah, I think in order to get that, you know, I've been really reflecting on what we've experienced the last couple of months. And, you know, one of our allies, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, their executive director was also under a lot of heat and fire from the Jewish community. And, you know, she really influenced me. And she said, you know, like, even though you're attacking me, I'm still fighting for you. And I come with love. And it's something I've been thinking a lot about with Thich Nhat Hanh, or in his conversation with Bell Hooks. I read in a conversation about it. And how do we get to that point? It's to find love for calling in instead of calling out, so that we can bring and build bridges amongst our communities, but not just about white supremacy, but capitalism. You know, that those two go, and patriarchy, they all go hand in hand with each other. Because if we don't talk about capitalism, we can't unite the larger working class of Asian immigrants with the larger picture of their understanding of how their system works.
I know on this program I certainly have taken the view that the master capitalists are white supremacists, in terms of, because I know a lot of people have different definitions for what they mean when they use that term. I've just concluded that whatever it is, whatever definition people are using, at the end of the day, capitalism, quote unquote, that is functioning under white supremacy and being used to just further strengthen white domination worldwide. We had a non-white male. He chimed in on our compensatory call in this past Saturday, and he didn't even know that you were coming on the program. This is what we're going to be talking about. But he said, I'm paraphrasing, basically the gist of it was, I think it is incorrect for us to lump Black people in with all of the non-white people and just say people of color or non-white people when we're talking about white supremacy, because Black people are subjected to just a much more intense mistreatment, much greater forms of terrorism under this system that can be quantifiably demonstrated, and that it's inaccurate, and that I just don't see enough non-white, non-Black people working to support Black people in solving this problem, that we should make it very clear and separately identify Black people and then all other non-white people when we're talking about white supremacy. I think I'm paraphrasing pretty accurately about the gist of what he said. What would your response to that be?
I mean, it's definitely true that there has to be acknowledgement and recognition of which community is most directly impacted by all the policies across the board, and it's the Black community across the country in the U.S. And we have to say, you know, non-Black people of color, to acknowledge, you know, the other communities who can ensure that there's separate space of where Black folks can come together and talk and struggle with each other and their frustration with what's happening. But when we talk about, when we organize and try to build community to build solidarity, for us to get to that point, we have to move through a process where we have to find and strain common struggle between our membership with other organizations' membership. That's how we build, but also making sure that it's that piece of the work, but they stand behind, you know, Black community members and organizations when it comes to a specific fight. So if it's, for example, you know, there's Black youth who are fighting for elimination of you know, cops in their schools, our youth are standing behind them, supporting them, and acknowledging that is a Black youth-specific issue. But then we get to a point where, you know, we have conversations amongst our youth to build solidarity with each other. And there is one piece of it where we have ensure separate conversations and safety where Black folks can air out their frustration and pain with non-Black POCs. But we have to also get to a point for us to build bridge to win. We have to make sure that we can thread our membership and their pain and struggle with other communities too.
Right on. I'm just pointing this out for listeners. We've had a sizable number of non-white, non-Black guests on the program. I think it's been unanimous. I think they have all conceded, yes, the darker you are, particularly if you are identified as a Black person, the system of white supremacy worldwide, you are going to be treated much worse. And I don't think anybody has offered any pushback, or it's exactly what you did. It's been easy. Oh, absolutely. No argument. Absolutely. Moving forward. Did you have time to take a few calls? We had folks who dialed in who wanted to ask a quick question. Did you have time for few questions from our listeners?
I can take about two questions.
Okay. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Kathy Dang? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Mrs. Dang.
Hi.
I had a quick question for you. First, I just wanted to say, calling from the New York area, my wife specifically, she's from Flushing, Queens, and she's a black female. And I must say that, you know, traveling to see her when we were first dating and things, that I've, in no white community I've been in, that I feel more discriminated and prejudiced than I felt from the Asians out there. I mean, it was totally chaotic. I just wanted to know, what percentage of the Asian community overall do you think are willing to put their struggle with the black people as opposed to those who are not? And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
What percentage of the Asian community will put themselves with the black? Are you saying you mean standing in solidarity and supporting the
black?
Well,
it seems like your point of view, the way that you've spoken on the show thus far, is much different than the point of view of the Asians from the clips that Gus has played. So I wanted to know, how many of the Asians do you think are more aligned with your point of view as opposed to those others?
I wouldn't be able to say a certain numerical percentage, but when all the rallies were happening in New York City where tens of thousands of people were shutting down the Manhattan Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Brooklyn Bridge, the West Side Highway, I can definitely say that we saw Asians everywhere standing behind black organizers who were leading the marches. I don't know the percentage. I know that Cav might seem like an outlier, but it's also more so the question of how much the media is used as a tool to control the narrative, to perpetuate the white supremacy. But on the everyday level, yes, it's true that the Asian immigrants who come to the U.S. fall within and have racist ideas and racist thoughts and ideology that needs to be undone. And, even within Asian communities, we can talk about colorism, and that plays out into our own communities too. And how much of white supremacy plays within our own communities, and how, for example, Southeast Asians are treated far different from Asians, from East Asians, and are treated, who are in the lowest rung of education access, and same with how South Asians are treated compared to East Asians in the U.S. And so, yes, one, definitely Asian immigrants can be racist, and can give you glares and give you looks. And I think the sad part is for us to find ways of how do you undo the racist ideology and also to undo colorism within our own communities, because it comes out to play too. And that has a lot to do with white supremacy.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Our other caller, this is our caller in Canada, north of the border. Do you have a question for Ms. Kathy Dang? You should be with us.
Okay. Thanks, Gus. So my question is basically this, because I heard out because I had to go a bit in and out. So apologies if it was asked in advance. So my question, is it complacency within white supremacy that creates anti-blackness in Asian communities? Or is it simply the fact that Asians are not affected by the particularities of anti-black racism, such as mass criminalization, just being one of them? And that's my question. I'll mute my line.
Yeah, it's definitely both. It's both. I think the complacency creates anti-blackness, yes. When you don't challenge the system, that creates just perpetuates everything that's happening every day with the policies impacting black communities across the U.S. And then two, they're not directly impacted by the same policies when it comes to mass incarceration. And where we try to build behind and make sure things like what happened with the Kyrie really doesn't happen again is being able to bring our membership and our immigrant base to understanding the larger structure and to support black organizations and black-led law organizing. That even we can tie their struggle around displacement and workers' rights to other black workers that are organizing, or gentrification in Harlem. It's making those connections so that we're able to build and make sure that Asian immigrants understand where they are when we talk about white supremacy and the role of whether you can be complacent or challenge it. And so it is both.
Okay. Right on. You said two questions. Did you have time? I just wanted to get in one quick comment to get your response before you part ways. Okay. With the shooting incident in Orlando that we talked about before, and even the conversation we were talking about Peter Liang, you mentioned identity politics and how sometimes that can obfuscate and lead us astray from trying to replace white supremacy with justice. At least one of the things, one of the thoughts that I have about this shooting in Orlando, and even broader, there is no group that I have seen that does a better job, or I'll say it this way, there are few people, few groups that do a better job at identity politics, quote unquote, than the LGBT community, mm-hmm. which is largely mm-hmm. dominated by white people that I suspect are practicing racism, where they are mm-hmm. able to do a fantastic job of portraying themselves as victims, even though these are many white people. I strongly think that they are practicing racism and not addressing mm-hmm. how non-white people who are in this community, LGBT community, how they mm-hmm. are victims of white supremacy, and how even white gays or white transgenders or white queers, how they also are practicing white supremacy. I think a lot of times that gets obscured, in my view. Mm-hmm. Even when it does get brought up, in my view, the black people that are LGBTQ, their problem, their most dominant problem is not the fact that they're gay or queer or transgender. Mm-hmm. The most dominant mm-hmm. problem in terms of why they are vulnerable is white supremacy. If they were black, even if they were not queer, they would still be vulnerable because of racism. Even if they were not transgender, they would still be vulnerable because of racism. Mm-hmm. If they were white, even if they were queer, or whatever the case may be, a lot of their problems would not exist anymore. They would be in a much better position in the world, worldwide, wherever they happen to be, just being a white person in the system of white supremacy. That is a major problem that I have with all of this in terms of how this generally gets mm-hmm. presented in terms of identity politics. In my view, nobody does it better than the white dominated LGBT community. What would your response to that be?
I mean, that is very true. You know, I think that's how the structure works. And so what I talk about when I was mentioning earlier, you know, of course Hillary's going to do whatever it'll take for her to be in the role of as actually a strong presidential candidate. It's because she's stepping on all other people, other women of color, with black women who have ran in the past, or Latino women who have ran in the past, to be where she is, to be closer to that structure, closer to the white man. And so when we talk about what you just raised, it's the same thing. It's the same thing of white gays doing whatever it can to just be closer to the top. And, you know, I think in a lot of the organizing in some in our cities, in our organizations, we recognize and we recognize and see that it's particular people who are impacted by the violence against queer and trans people. And particularly in New York City, there's I think 23 black trans women who were killed, and nothing's being done in those cases. Being very specific and clear that we support CAV as an organization and people in the movement need to make sure that we continue to acknowledge that, and that their voices are on the forefront, because their voices, our voices is all that we have, and we got to uplift those voices who are most directly impacted by this whole tragedy. And we have to admit our responsibility when we talk about Asian Americans being responsible, you know, for what people are doing. We have the collective responsibility for collective liberation. We as allies, or we as people who don't feel or are more directly impacted by what happened, is to elevate those voices, to make sure that their voices come before the mainstream LGBT narrative that's coming out, that's whitewashed.
Right on. Executive Director of CAV, that's Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. You can go to their website, caaav.org. Miss Kathy Dang, has been grand to have you on the program. We definitely will look forward to having you back to speak with us down the road soon. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening and keep up the outstanding work that you all are doing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Have a good evening.
For sure. You too.
All right. Bye.
Good evening. Context of White Supremacy, Kathy Dang. wish we had had her with us longer. I know there were other folks who dialed in who had questions. Again, we'll hope we can get her back on the program so some of the folks who didn't get a chance to get their question in, you can do so at a later date, and or even people who listen to the archive of this program will be able to dial back in as well to share some of their views. I will, I guess I'll see if I can get the agenda here for how I'd like to use the time that we have left with the program. For folks who dialed in, I'll get the folks who dialed in who did not get a chance to ask their question, or even if you did get a chance to ask a question, Thomaston, New York, our caller in Canada. If you have commentary that you would like to share based on what you heard from Kathy Dang, we can make time for that. As I said, I had an update from the program that we did yesterday with Christopher Clark, the white male, and I'm only saying suspected racist to not name call. I have an update from that program as well. He joined us from South Africa yesterday. And then if folks had any commentary that they wanted to get on what happened in Orlando, we did spend a little bit of time talking about that yesterday. And even we talked about it with Kathy Dang today. We'll make some time for that as well. So that's kind of the agenda for how we can use the time that we have left. So I'll start. The folks who are on the line who did not get a chance to ask Kathy, a question. I'll get your line, so if you would like to comment based on what you heard, if it was logical, if it makes sense, or even if you had a question that you wanted to ask and just didn't get an opportunity, if you want to share what question you would have asked if we'd had more time with her. The folks that dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open. I guess I'll give out the number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. So I guess that'll be, we'll compartmentalize. So the first section of what we'll address, folks who have commentary based on what they heard from Kathy Dang about the Peter Liang shooting or other things that she addressed, feel free to chime in. The folks who have a hand up with us thus far, line should be open, and we should hear from folks who we have not heard from thus far. If you did not get to ask a question, feel free to chime in.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, yes, good evening, Gus. I just had a couple of observations from what you guys talked about tonight. And basically, her responses were very, very similar to a white person who's claiming to not be a part of the racist white supremacy system. You asked her, for instance, about how she was complicit and how she practices racism. She went right to benefits and privileges, just like a white woman would. When you played the clip of the Chinese guy who said that they were the last class, she took that, turned it around, and she said this was a male problem, so she threw patriarchy into the mix instead of racism. And lastly, you asked her about the Chinese people being interested in upholding racism, white supremacy, instead of being a part of a people of color coalition. And she turned that around and blamed it on classism. So to me, she's very well trained in the system of racism, white supremacy, and the buckets and buckets of words would have been really appropriate tonight.
Interesting. Other folks who...
those were some great observations.
Other folks who we have not heard from, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
Oh, you can go ahead, sis. I'll go after you.
Oh, okay, thank you. This is Akua from Milwaukee. I wanted to ask her. I know I live here in Milwaukee, and like where the Asians, they have their businesses, their stores, and the black communities, like they treat black people horribly. But like you see, some of the Asian businesses out, you know, where more white people live, and they get treated so much better. You know, they treat white people so much better, and they come in our neighborhoods and treat us, you know, like garbage. And I guess I was just thinking, like, well, where is the, I don't know, the coming together, where is the unity, you know, with that? It's she's saying that we have the same issues and the same problems, but they treat white people different than they you know, than they treat us. So I guess I was just going to ask her, like, you know, why is that? If we're supposed to be working together, and we're supposed to be having the same issues and fighting against white supremacy. And so that's all I had. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to actually ask her, because I sent you an article, you and Thomas, that discussed after the commercial situation with the Chinese woman who pushed the black male into the washing machine and he came out as a fair-skinned Asian male. There was an article that was put out where the Chinese government basically said that the West brought racism to China, and that they didn't have a race problem until essentially they encountered white people. He also discussed the fact that Asians never went around the world and facilitated slavery of other groups of people based on race. And I wanted to ask her, actually, if she agreed with that, if she believed that the West actually brought racism to China the way it was expressed in that commercial, and even the way that it is expressed with the Asian American community here, or if it's something that was inherent in, let's say, Chinese society per se. I wanted to get her take on that. And also, in regards to the, the shooting in Florida, it's coming out now that the shooter was gay himself. So I just find it very interesting that white supremacist news media is going down the line of Islamophobia and, you know, terrorism, when he's basically, they talked to people he went to school with in college who said he was all over gay bars with them. Actually, the place that he shot up, there were people there that knew him. Some of the security guards said that he had come there before. So essentially, this was a gay on gay violence, if there's any better way of putting it. Because he was basically a homosexual male that I believe probably couldn't accept his homosexuality, or was angry about being homosexual, and took it out on other homosexuals. And like you said, I find it very telling, too, that the vast majority of people that were shot were so-called Latinos, non-white people, and no one is focusing on that. Everyone is focusing on the gay issue. And the last thing I wanted to say is the difference to me between black males who are homosexual today and black males who are homosexual, let's say, in the 60s, and I'll give a great example, James Baldwin. He never put his sexuality above his race, because he understood that his issue with this in this country had to do with him being black, not being homosexual. And I think it's the reverse is true today. A lot of black people and other non-whites have been indoctrinated into the sexuality issue, instead of understanding that if a cop guns you down, it's because you're a black person. They don't see that you're gay. They see that you're a nigger, and that's what they're killing you for. And thank you for taking my call, Gus. I'll mute my line.
Other folks who dialed in who have comments here that we have not heard from, did you all have comments you wanted to get in? I see other hands. Anybody else have commentary they wanted to get in, what they heard from Kathy Dang, folks we haven't heard from?
Can I be heard? Oh, you can go ahead.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I find it interesting that she was stuck on America. She wasn't talking about how racism, specifically anti-blackness, is, you know, global. She kept on stressing about immigrants coming from different Asian countries, and basically she made it sound like they're being, like, used by the other agents who supposedly have money. But I was reading an article the other day that was talking about anti-blackness in, like, India and Asia, which is, they're not immigrants. That's where they live. So to me, it's not about the immigrants. It's about the anti-blackness. And I don't see Indians, Koreans, Chinese, I don't see them come into the aid of black people, because the only thing that they have going for them is that they're not black. You know what I mean? And if black people are the ones getting the worst end of the stick, oh, it's a metaphor, right? If black people are the ones that are being abused, mostly, why would anybody want to be black? Not even black people want to be black. So I understand why there is no coalition between Asians and black people. And that's my commentary on Ms. Dang for now. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I kind of like didn't hear a lot of the broadcast, but from the little bit that I did listen to, it did seem that the host was kind of like, I don't want to use a metaphor, so let me get more to accuracy, wasn't very clear on the aspect of racism, white supremacy from the standpoint of a non-white person having a clear understanding of what it is and how it works. On to, and I would it be correct for me to go to Orlando? Or should I wait?
Is it related to something she had to say about Orlando, or is it just your own comments?
No. It's not. Oh, okay. No, it's not.
I'd like to just kind of move clean away once everybody's done with the Kathy Dang portion.
Oh, okay.
We can move clean to Orlando because I'm sure other folks have comments on that, if that's acceptable.
Right on. Right on.
Did you want to explain how you thought her lack of understanding of white supremacy, what it is, how it works, how that was demonstrated in the broadcast and the exchange?
It appeared to me that when it was some kind of like direct questions on the relationship between non-white black people and non-white people who are called Asian, and it didn't seem that whether or not it was a constructive relationship or not, it didn't seem like she was very clear on that question, on whether or not there is a constructive one, and I'm hearing the experiences from a lot of non-white black people, and I haven't heard one that clearly stated that their experience from non-white people who are called Asians was a constructive one, and I can basically chime in by saying mine haven't been very constructive either. So it sounds like hers was very unclear to me. It was unclear. I just put it that way. It wasn't really clear. And the question was kind of straight, kind of more straightforward than what her answers were. That's what hopefully I answered your question.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's all I have to say about the program tonight.
Right on. We will get to the Orlando thing as soon as everybody, whatever they want to share, observations from Ms. Kathy Dang, and then we'll get to the Orlando thing so you can share on that as well. Anybody that we missed? I thought the other caller in Florida, did you have commentary you were going to share?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I found it to be a very interesting interview. I really like kind of like what the previous caller was just talking about the understanding of white supremacy. Like I really wanted to see if she associated with any white people, like white acquaintances or white friends, because that would delve into, like, I noticed that if white people are around a certain label of non-white. Like if they were around Asian people, if they were practicing racism, saying racist jokes, and throwing out the different stereotypes of black people, like do they expect their Asian, I guess, associates or subjects really to basically parrot or agree with any anti-black jokes? Because I kind of have a feeling that, you know, white people will engage in that behavior sometimes. Well, they'll say racist jokes about a particular group outside of their presence. Like they'll say racist jokes about black people, but it'll only be maybe like white people and some Asians around. They will expect the Asian people to laugh and agree with the jokes. Because I've noticed that there have been a lot of Asian stereotypical jokes by a lot of white people on the job. And I won't really agree or anything, but you know, I just thought about that dynamic. I don't know if it's a word for that. It just goes to show the effect that they've had on us. You know, I really would like to have heard more clarity about the effect, the close personal effect on the minds of white people who classified as Asian. By white people, like what things are they telling them? You know, hey, these are black people, you know, they're nothing, they're worthless. It might not have been nothing direct, you know, it could have been something indirect, maybe school experiences, you know, things like that. But overall, I pretty much enjoyed the interview. And that's all I have.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and the listeners. I am definitely in collusion with the last two callers about. I listened to what she was saying, and it sounds like with. When you hear other people speaking about racism and but they bring in other issues. And for me, like the last caller, how he was just saying that, you know, when jokes are being told about black people, you know, what are the jokes? First of all, what are the jokes that are being told? Secondly, are you participating in any way, whether negative or positive? Because it sounds like I won't even go with what it sounds like. I'll go with my experience with Asian Americans, whether Laotian, Korean, Chinese, from wherever. It's always the same sense of white privilege, same sense of supremacy, white supremacy, where as long as you stay in line, Negro, you good. As long as you... You know, as long as you don't supersede me in anything, we're fine. As long as I can outcompete you and things like that, and I can make more money than you and whatever, it's fine. And I go right back to, but when you supersede that, when you go past that, when you do better than them, which by nature you are, it's something that happens. When that happens, you see the true colors. You see that. It's not a friendship, it's not even a partner. It's like a one and you're the two. And it's all, I found my experience with Asians always, it's always been like that, always. And like I said, I go back to what Mother Wilson said, it's a deep-seated hate, genetic hate from the genetic level, from the phallus, from what we have potentially, what we can do potentially to their race. And you go along with every other race, and it's the same thing. They act the same way. So I can't, when I hear people from other groups, nationalities, that speak about their issues and, you know, speak about racism is wrong and this and that, I'm like Scotty. Like Scotty Reed, I don't hear them talking about abolition. I don't hear you talking about abolishing slavery. When you start talking about abolishing slavery, you start talking about why people really hate us, why they really have that fear for us, that hate for us, that kind of, like I said before, you good as long as you stay in the place that I have for you. You get out of that place in any kind of way, you'll see my true colors. There's no friendship, no relationship, there's none of that. It's just my place and your place. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
You try to get Mr. Fuller's concept, I think, is extremely important. There is one race. That is the white race. Nobody else qualifies as a race. I think that's extremely important. I think that does end up generating a lot of confusion, thinking that there are multiple races and other people belong to a race. I could be in error, but at least my conclusion definitively, there is one race. That is the white race. That's it, though. Other folks, anybody that we missed who had a hand up that had comments they wanted to get in? Anybody that we missed that we hadn't heard from? We get everybody who had a hand up, anybody that we have not heard from, who had commentary on Kathy Dang. All right. I assume we're good. Anybody, even if you did get a chance to get a question in, Thomas in New York, our caller in Canada, do y'all have any comments you want to get in on Kathy Dang or anybody who had additional comments they wanted to get in on Kathy Dang before we move to different topics?
You know, I agree with the first guy said that she kind of played it a lot like a white supremacist. And I'm not sure if I agree that she doesn't have an in-depth knowledge of racism. I think that she knows a lot more than she put on. She was doing what they normally do, play ignorant. A lot of the same patterns, like the guy said, I mean, when you think about it, it was almost to a script what you would expect from a white person. And I try not to look at Asians as anything other than, victims. But, like I said, my wife, she's from Flushing, Queens, and Flushing, Queens is Chinatown on steroids. I mean, I didn't even know this many Chinese people lived in New York until I went to see her one day, and I was like, my God. I mean, they even got their own project. I mean, I never saw nothing like it before. And, I must say that they're very rude. I mean, you go into their store, what are you doing here? You know, it's almost like, we don't want your business. I mean, it was no problem here. I'll walk right out. But, I just feel like they definitely have a lot of anti-blackness. You know, I wouldn't call them racist. And I think that she was definitely, doing a lot of stuff that white people do. I never thought of that. Remember, you had a guest on before, Gus, a Chinese guy. I think he was a security guard or something.
Freddie Lee, the infamous.
Yeah, like that. I really think that the majority of Chinese people feel like Freddie Lee, feel like those people on the bridge. They're not like her, And I'll meet my line on that. Thank you.
People on the bridge? What does that mean?
Brooklyn Bridge, the clip you played with those Asian men.
Got it.
And, yeah.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to say something because those are some really great points that were brought up by Thomas and the brother who was speaking earlier about the fact that she kind of answered questions in a way that a white person would. What I tend to see is that once a non-black, non-white person has been indoctrinated with white supremacy and they get infected with it, even if they do counter-racist work, they have a very skewed view because their view is already tainted towards black people already. And I think it's very hard for them to completely exorcise that out of their system. And also because I think writers who write about racism, white supremacy, let's say the Asian experience and things like that, I don't think there's many other groups that have that global understanding of racism, I don't know if they have access to like Neely Fuller's work or Dr. Welsing's work or Dr. Marimba Ani's work, but I think that they don't get that sort of insight into the way it functions. And once they're infected with with racism, white supremacy, and that anti-blackness, I think that whatever approach they take to counter racist work will always be skewed in some way because it's just the way it functions. And I think she's a great example of that. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to say I definitely agree. And what the two gentlemen just said, definitely agree. Your whole take on it is skewered. So everything that comes out.
And somebody's got their speakerphone. I'm gonna open your line back up. So I was just somebody's speak sounded like we were getting some interference, like it was echoing when you were speaking. Let's see if it's corrected. Let's try again, sir.
Let's try again. Is it better?
Give us another sentence.
Is that better? Can you hear me better now?
Sounds good. Go ahead.
Sounds good. Cool. I just want to disagree with them. It just that once your take on it is once you've been affected by racism, white supremacy, and you haven't had, as he said, Neely Fuller or Mother Wilson's, take on it, their view on it, everything that comes out, it sounds like it comes from a white person, even if you're not a white person. Sounds cold. Sounds codified. And I'm going to mute my line on that.
I think we should have asked her if she read those books, because maybe she has read those books before instead of assuming that she has not. Me personally, I have a very, it's super difficult for me to not view Asians negatively.
Sorry about that, ma'am.
Was I causing an echo?
I'm not sure. Speak. You have to keep talking, and I'll see where it's coming from.
Okay. I'm sounding clear. I'm coming through.
You're clear so far. Continue. Sorry about that.
Okay. I lost my train of thought, so I'm going to let somebody else speak.
You were saying it's difficult for you to not view Asians negatively?
Right. It's hard for me to not view them as negatively and almost put them as on the same wavelength as white people as being racist because of their nasty, irreverent, this disgusting attitude that they have towards black people. You know what I mean? Because as people have been saying on the line, you know, the interaction that you do have with them, it's all negative. It's all negative. I don't think I have had a positive interaction with an Asian person, you know, because they just spew that racist thing that they learn. And I mean, like, I know that the caller just spoke about people being infected with racism, but I mean, like, everybody's infected with racism. It's not contained to a certain group, you know what I mean? But yeah, man, definitely can't stand Asians. Can't stand them.
The person that dialed in 6133, did you have commentary you were going to add? Caller at 6133, did you have commentary you were going to add? Or are you just listening? Oh, whoops, I gave out the caller.
I want to add one. I worked in Saudi Arabia and with a lot of mostly Filipinos, and they are the most racist people against black people I have ever encountered. I mean, and I'm not upset with them. I mean, they're about Filipinos first, and, you know, but it's the thing I'm thinking about, the only ones that are confused about this people of color thing is us.
everyone else is about self-preservation, their own people first. We are the only people who are confused about how that works. So we don't understand when we go into their shops and say, if we try to sell them something, they'll look at you like you're crazy, like every dollar that comes out of their pocket is going to go to their people. But we give them our dollars, but if you try to sell them anything, they look at you like, are you crazy? If anything comes out of my pocket, it's going to go to my people. But so I think it's something that we are confused about and not everybody else.
The caller in Michigan, did you have commentary you were going to add?
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
you're... Go ahead.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers. I'll be brief. Thought of something. I heard bits and pieces of the guest this evening, but I had an interesting experience when I was at work today. I got on the elevator, and there's a Japanese company within the building that I work at, and there were two so-called Japanese that got on the elevator with me, and it was just so cold, the experience. They were, you know, it was a female, and then a male got on right at the same time as I did, and I just noticed, you know, she spoke to the male, and it was just a cold ride on the elevator, how, you know, it was like I wasn't there, just like you were no different than the light bulb in the elevator. So I get that experience a lot, except for, you know, if I'm at a nail shop or something like that, then, you know, it's a different experience. And so I thought about how confusing it is when I hear so-called Jewish people who, I think you had a guest, I was listening to an archive show where a lady was talking about how the Jewish or the Irish became white or something like that. Did you have a guest on that they were talking about the Irish or was it Jewish people who became white?
Both, actually. Noel Ignatieff was how the Irish became white, and Karen, I'm just forgetting her last name, but she did the book How Jews Became White.
Okay, and so I was listening to, I think, both, and it was still confusing. I walked away not understanding how they became white. But when I look at how other non-white people, that's not black, with light skin, I just take it as, you know, they're just trying to get on the white team. And whatever we have to do to prove that we, you know, are far, you know, we are not supporting white black people, they get rewarded, you know. And so the treatment that they give us the coldness, I mean, I just come to expect it. And I was also listening to Mr. Fuller, how he, you know, basically says we're in this, it's an independent fight or battle. And I just now understand not to expect anyone, black people, non-white people, to, you know, this is something, a battle that I have to fight on my own for the most part, and to really wrap myself around the idea of justice instead of trying to look for other people for so-called allies. So that's all I wanted to add.
Mm-hmm. Karen Brodkin, that's her name, Karen Brodkin. She did How Jews Became White. She was on in 2010. The caller at 4950, did you have commentary you were going to add? 4950.
Yes, greetings to Gus, the listeners that call us. I was just curious to wonder, I was thinking, has anyone else thought that it could be like another embedded divide and conquer thing that we can't get along with other races, or they can't get along with us, or even work with us to try to solve the problem?
Again, there it is again, see? One race, the white race, one race.
Well, other groups.
Can I answer that, Gus?
For sure.
All right. I would say that is
absolutely correct as far as divide and conquer, because all of the non-white people that are subject to white supremacy, none of them have a holistic understanding of it being a global system and the fact that all white people function the same way no matter where in the world you encounter them. There's very few people that have that understanding. And it was the way that other groups were dealt with versus the way we were dealt with, black people I'm speaking of. Black people got the worst of everything. And because these other groups did not have the type of mistreatment we had, they weren't stripped of their identity, their name, their language, none of that stuff. We got all of that. So our experiences are uniquely different to every other ethnic group that is non-white that is also trying to fight the system. And also because they are subject to white supremacy, they also want some of the benefits that come with abusing black people, because essentially they've now become a buffer class to protect white people from us, essentially. And that's the role that I've seen Asians play. And just to speak to the sister that I was talking earlier, I actually did say all other non-white groups. I didn't specify Chinese people in particular. And my personal experience was very horrible with Asian Americans as well. One of my earlier experiences with racism actually came at a Korean market, a fruit market I went to with my mother in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue off of 7th Avenue. And they followed us all around. My mother was looking for stuff to cook. And she ended up giving him all kind of four-letter words, superlatives, and then we ended up leaving and going elsewhere. So it's an experience that I've had. And then in my own family, I think I talked about this once before, but I have what we call Douglas in Trinidad, which are basically African-Indian Trinidadians. And I don't deal with any of my they're actually, I have about two aunts and three uncles. I don't deal with any of them but one, because they actually have the same attitude that East Indians have, which is that caste system attitude, and niggers are at the bottom. The Dalits, with the untouchables, the black Indians, they treat African Americans or black people, period, in Trinidad or wherever they encounter them, just like Brahmin Indians, which are the lighter or whiter Indians, treat the Dalits. So it's an experience I've had within my family, and it's also an experience I've had outside in this country, and it's definitely something that I agree with. And I think that if we cannot come to a holistic understanding of the way the system works, which will give us a holistic way of dealing with it, even if it is united independent, it's going to just continue to be what it's always been, and that's where white people have been most successful, is at keeping us at odds with one another, because if we're at odds with one another, we're not paying attention to them. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
The caller at 0423, did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Hi, it's Lady. Hi, everyone on the line. Actually, I did have a few comments. I haven't really had a lot of those type of negative experiences with persons who are Asian American. Unfortunately, I don't know how to differentiate between like certain groups, like Cambodian and Laotian. I know we have where I live, we have a lot of those people in that community. I do notice that when I used to frequent their restaurants or places where of business, that if a white person came in, it was almost like I was invisible. Even if I was like right at the counter ready to make my purchase, they locked in on the white person as if I didn't matter anymore. And I'm very surprised to hear from some of the other ladies on the line. To me, the men were very, very flirtatious. This is before I had kids, and anytime I had an encounter with them, it was like, you don't want to date me, you don't want to see me. Like, was very just how people describe Asian Americans as very, like, docile and calm. To me, it was just almost kind of, I wouldn't say aggressive, but like, oh, come on, I'm Asian and you're black, you know you want to date me. Mentality from a lot of the men, and this is older and younger men, so I was very surprised to not hear any of the ladies have any of those experiences of Asian men trying to date them. But other than that, I have not had a lot of negative experience. The guest did sound like a white woman, though. Just everything that she said, I agree, sounded like a white person was giving their analysis on racism. And sound like how a white woman would, to me, say, this is how I'm helping to counter racism, and this is my ties to other communities. And, you know, there's never a central focus of, you know, there are people who are mistreated and these people are mistreated more, which are Black people. I just didn't get that from her. And there seems to be an overall denial of that from a lot of the non-white, non-Black callers, is that overall, all areas of activity, Black people are treated terribly, and it needs to stop. So I guess, you know, that's just something that's not going to happen, or I'm not going to hear from the non-white, non-Black guests that call in. So that was all I had to say. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
What I have been hearing for probably the past 20, 30 minutes is the global system of racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works. And in me saying that, I understand that under the Department of non-white people, the non-white people who are called Black, nigger, Negroes, the assortment of words that we are called, are treated the worst. It's a strategy that white people who choose to practice racism and who are the most powerful of people behave. And in turn, it causes the effect out of non-white people of fighting one another. And as I mentioned before, and I'm going to add on into the equation, Dr. Franz Quest Welsing, probably because of we have the most powerful genetic potential. It's probably one of the reasons why we're mistreated the most. And white people, I believe, have an understanding of this. Even more so, what the global system of racism, white supremacy causes, it causes non-white Black people to fight terribly with each other. And our reaction to the system of racism, white supremacy, we're so confused, a lot of us behave terrible with one another. So it's sort of like a double whammy, as you used to play years ago, that we're confronted with. So this is what I'm verbally hearing in a descriptive way. And I think it is logical and it holds true. Although it is terrible in its practice, by having an understanding of that, I would say, because just about everything I'm hearing, I agree with, but I still think we should keep our focus on white people. I mean, I could mention about atrocities that took place with the very people that we're talking about right now. The only nuclear bombs that were dropped on people were a group that is called Asians, that are called Japanese. And that was a particular purpose, as opposed to white people who are called Germans. Almost a whole area of people who were called Chinese at one time were purposely put on heroin during I think it was the early part of the 21st century. white people who call themselves English imposed that. So they had the atrocities also. And in turn, like I said before, the negative interactions that non-white, non-black people have on us is manipulated and orchestrated by the global system of racist white supremacy, because they control all nine areas of activity, and in turn, it produces non-white people to be scrambling and scratching and fighting each other. And in that pecking order, non-white black people are on the bottom. And as I mentioned before, double whammy in this, how much we're impacted. We actually, in a lot of cases, are warring against ourselves. So that makes it even tougher for us. And that's all I have to say for right now.
Double whammy.
We had Thomas, I think, wanted to respond to the question, and we had before we get to him, there was a female caller that I don't think we had heard from. The only quick comments I wanted to get in, I think since Muhammad Ali's name has been invoked so much over the past few weeks, I think it was Muhammad Ali who refused to go participate in a war that was being raged against non-white people, I believe her parents, the area of the world that her, Kathy Deng's parents, were born in. Folks needed other illustrations of how globally non-white people are bombarded by white terrorism, black people being subjected to the worst forms of that, no question. The things that I wanted to make sure I got in before we get Thomas in New York, the other caller that dialed in, and move to commentary on what's going on in Orlando. I think number one, I thought it was significant, extremely important, actually, what she said about she received threats or was mistreated. They put her home information out or what have you for attempting to help black people fight against racism. I think that is important. I hadn't heard that before, but I think that would support the notion that I think some folks were talking about. If you make an effort to support black people, you are going to catch it. You are not supposed to be helping those Negras, and that's going to be an added factor in terms of something that we'll have to deal with in terms of trying to solve this problem, just making an effort to speak out. And I would say that seems to go even for other black people. If you make an effort to try to help aid other black people in fighting against racism, you can expect some mistreatment yourself. It's supposed to be, who cares? Just another nigga mistreated. Let's go on about our day doing what we're supposed to be doing. Also thought she mentioned Kathy Deng. I think she said that she had, it was some Jewish organization. I don't remember the name. I'd have to go back and hear it again. But I remember distinctly it was some Jewish organization in New York. I suspect these are white people. I think people were saying, does she work with other white people and how that likely impacts the way that they talk about racism, their understanding of racism, if they think of these people, even though she said Jewish, I strongly suspect that they're white people. I seriously doubt that these are Jews that look like Sammy Davis Jr. or some of the black people that we've had as guests on this program who also identify as being Jewish. I seriously doubt that, but I could be in error. So I think she gave us that response during the program that they do work with white people that are probably racist, and I'm sure that has a big impact in terms of how they discuss work against racism, white supremacy. In terms of her sounding like or giving responses that typical white people would give when they talk about racism, it's been my experience that that is most victims of racism, including black people. They tend to sound very similar to the way that white people talk about racism, or if I could say it another way, they will talk about racism, white supremacy in a way that is acceptable to whites. I could list specific folks by name, but I will not do that. But I think we've had quite a few of them here, and specifically mentioning capitalism or mentioning patriarchy or bringing up the LGBTQ issue. I think the vast majority of black people who talk about racism, they do the exact
same thing. I think, if anything, I think that shows what a spectacular job white supremacists have done to contaminate, to obfuscate, to confuse the way that we think about our understanding of racism, white supremacy. It's been my experience. It's very rare that you bump into black people, non-white people on the whole, whether they're black or not, who have an analysis, an assessment of racism, white supremacy, and articulate it as this is global white terrorism. Black people are the ones who are subjected to it worst, first and foremost, and not bringing in a whole lot of other stuff, ableism and patriarchy and blah, 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 and all this other stuff. That is extremely rare, unless I've been misinformed. Again, I could stand by evidence of just the folks who have come on this here program over the past 7+ years. I think even some of you all have noted this before amongst other guests, non-white, non-black, and black. But that, again, is an indictment of white people and just how successful their contingent has been. Folks like Timothy Wise, Peggy McIntosh, other white people, when they give their presentations on racism, they make sure to include all that other stuff that I say is largely nonsense just to confuse the issue. I could be in error. The female caller who chimed in, did you have commentary 5992?
Oh, no, because I don't want to comment on the guest. I want to comment on Donald Trump.
Oh, okay. We're about to move forward. Thomas in New York, were you going to respond to the question that was put forward?
Yes, I was, Gus. I'll be very brief. First of all, someone said other groups practice self-preservation. And what I've learned from groups that say they practice, it seems like they practice self-preservation. It doesn't top their hunger for white validation. Because as soon as a white person steps in the room, all that self-preservation goes out the window, and they go to try to help that white person. So I just don't think that they're still under the system. As for answering the question, I would just challenge everyone to study Asian history and just see what white people have done to them over the course of history. It's just been, if you want to do a case study on white supremacy, I would say that would be a great place to go. Because we know Africa. But this here is not as bad as what's been done to us, but it's been some serious stuff done to them. And as a result, their culture has been kept in place, but they lost a lot as a result to keep their culture. And the number one export that the United States ships out worldwide is anti-blackness. And those people, Asians, however, that group, we can't count on them or any other group to help us, because all those groups have been grown up in the system, and they've been bombarded with nothing but anti-blackness ever since they've been in their country. Just hip hop alone, just send a bunch of videos over there, and just imagine how they view black people. So, That's what I wanted to answer the question with, was, we can't count on no other groups to help us, period. It's all about us at this point, because those other groups are fulfilled with anti-blackness, and they're going to serve the purpose of the white supremacists.
Right on. Just as it was mentioned before, I would just echo United Independent. I would say even individuals who are classified as black, unfortunately, we too are filled with anti-blackness, and you probably are going to be disappointed more often than not, depending on them to fight against racism. You should probably depend on yourself, United Independent, working to fight against racism, looking to other victims, black, non-white, non-black. You're probably going to be in for a lot of disappointment. Am I talking crazy?
Not to me.
Nope.
Right on. Before we get to the, I guess, I don't know if the Donald Trump piece was related to the Orlando shooting. It seems like most of what I've heard related to Donald Trump has been connected with the Orlando shooting over the past 48 hours or so. But before we get to that, we had the program we had yesterday with Christopher Clark, the white male, South Africa, cowbell, black partner, alleges to be working against racism. He emailed me today. He said that he
went back and listened to the archive and listened to the comments that we shared after the program was done. And I'm going to put this on my blog. White people listen to our program. It's not just him. Tim Wise and others have listened to our program. This would be my warning. Don't think you're going to act a fool and send Gus any tackiness and it not be public. I'm going to put this on my blog. I would keep all of your tacky and trashy comments to yourself or share them with other whites. If you send them to Gus, it is going to be public. Just a further illustration of what we're really dealing with. Now, so he wrote Gus. Again, you can go back in the archives and check out the program. This white guy, he was born in the UK. He's been on the continent on the whole, but specifically in South Africa for a few years. He did admit to moving around and going to different regions over the past, I think he said, 5 or 6 years or so. As I said, he's in a tragic arrangement with a black female. They're not married. They don't have any children. We asked him about that in detail on the program yesterday, and he alleges that he's trying to amend or work against racism by hanging out in what he calls black spaces around black people and going and shooting videos in like the ghettos, the shanty towns in South Africa at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and blah, blah, blah. You can listen to the archives. Anywho, so he wrote this letter. I will read what he had to say. It is a little lengthy, and it does have quite a few expletives in it. I'm not omitting or censoring anything so that everyone gets the full dose of exactly what he had to say from a well-meaning, good white man from the continent, on the continent presently. So he writes, I just re-listened to our talk and the subsequent commentary, if it can be called that. Firstly, I think it's a huge cop-out for you to dismiss so much of what I said and in such a callous manner once I was already off air. I would have been more than happy to deal with your snarky comments on air, but I guess that wouldn't have worked so well with your agenda, right? Secondly, how dare you speak about my relationship with my partner the way you did while I was on air and even more so subsequently. Excuse my language, but you know sweet fuck all about her, her background, her family, or the details of our relationship. Who the fuck are you to say that we won't stay together or speculate about why we are not already married or to assume that that is automatically my decision rather than a mutual one or her decision for that matter? Who the fuck are you to assume that you can police other people's life or relationship choices, whatever their race? Important metaphor, police, as though Gus has some military apparatus to come to South Africa and nigger knock him upside the head and make him do this or do that in the area of sex. Moving forward. Thirdly, I was being completely genuine when I thanked you for the grilling. I am sincerely interested in understanding more about racism and how to confront it, and I felt I had learned valuable lessons from you and your callers in this regard, even though I don't agree with everything that was leveled at me. I don't see how seeing this as valuable and giving thanks for that is something that can also be perceived as negative. But then it seems clear now that you are incapable of taking anything from a white person as something that is not completely and inherently negative. Please tell me how the fuck such a one-sided view is productive for anyone, black or white. And yes, much of our conversation was uncomfortable for me. Why is that bad? I have honestly never had to answer or counter some of the questions or theories you posed, whether from white people or black people, and I certainly wasn't expecting some of them either. I'll just stop right there to include. I actually did send this white man a list of questions that I wanted to cover. Not everything that I asked him was there, but I sent him at least 10, 15 questions that I wanted to cover. I might have neglected to include the sexual aspect. That might have been something that I found out a little bit later as I continue to read his blog, because he wrote about being involved in a sexual relationship with a black person. So I certainly felt like it was just to ask him about that since he's talked about it publicly already. But I did send him my about 10 to 15 of the questions I wanted to cover beforehand. Moving forward. But was I dishonest at any stage? Absolutely not. When I was uncertain about something, I said as much. When I hesitated or chuckled, it was because I was feeling nervous or awkward or stunned by the directness of a question and didn't have a definitive answer. I'm also acutely aware of professing certainties about such complex issues that I'm still learning about and analyzing on a daily basis. Next up, do all white people sit around and conspire about how to talk to Negroes in a manipulative and evasive way? Did I honestly hear you ask that question? Are you fucking serious? Newsflash, my man. There are good people trying to do the right thing, Spike Lee, and live their life right across all races, including among whites. There are most definitely non-racist and anti-racist white people. Though they are admittedly a minority, there are also prejudiced people across all races, including amongst blacks. Now, that is fascinating for many reasons. Just one I will point out, if you listen to the program on yesterday, I believe our female caller in Michigan who's present now asked him, how would we identify the white people who are not racist? And that was one that stumped him. Admittedly, he said he had no idea, but he can definitively declare in his message here that there are good white people, even though he could not give us any means efficiently to identify these people yesterday. Moving forward. I think I know myself pretty well, and I know that I am a good person who tries to treat everyone I encounter with respect, empathy, and dignity. I honestly think it's sad that you are obviously so unwilling to see the good in certain types of people or situations. I came onto your show with nothing but good and honest intent, and you refuse to see that. I think you'd already made up your mind before we even started talking, hence the resounding triumph in your voice whenever you felt I'd lived up to your preconceived ideas, and then to even be insulted by you for defending my own mother. That was a new level of bullshit for me. Who wouldn't stick up for their own mother if they thought she was being portrayed unfairly and later greatly misquoted, taken out of context in your commentary? It's not because she is white, it's because she is a good woman who I love and who has done a tremendous amount for me. How the fuck is sticking up for someone like that so hard to understand? And the fact that I'm unwilling to disclose the contents of a private email she sent me says nothing apart from the fact that I'm not willing to share everything with someone who I don't know live on air. And with regards to the lack of addendum you pointed out at the post about what my mom said to me, I didn't think it was necessary to what I was trying to get across in that blog post. Just for listeners, he did write publicly about his mom possibly being racist. She sent him, he requested that she send him Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Mask. That would be a cowbell. She did send it to him, and I guess she included a letter or some sort of text basically saying that she thought this book was really skewed in its analysis, and maybe she should have got him a book that offered a different perspective on world history, a different worldview to balance things out. That's kind of the gist of what the post was saying, and I cited that because I asked him yesterday, because he had said that his own family members were racist. I asked him if there were any ways that his mom was racist. He said he couldn't think of any off the top of his head, and I said that I thought that was a deliberate act of racism because he had specifically written about his mom's response to getting Frantz Fanon's book. And he did point out that that was logical, but he said that she later commented or wrote him to say that he had misunderstood what she had to say. That was kind of at the end of before he parted the program. Moving forward. Also, if I were you, I'd do some more research on what Bantustans were before you start throwing that word around. Just some friendly advice before you start talking about ignorance. And he has a little smiley face there. In all honesty, you lost all credibility for me when I listened to your commentary. That was just really shitty talk radio, man. I'm sure you'll find some way to turn this all around and make it about my inherent racism and white power or policing your blackness, but it's really not about any of that. It's just about you behaving like a presumptuous, judgmental asshole. So fuck you, quite frankly. That is Christopher Clark, well-meaning white man who was on the broadcast yesterday. I guess for him it was yesterday evening. For us it was pretty early in the afternoon yesterday. It's in the archives. You can go back and listen to what he had to say. And again, this is from a well-meaning white man who talked about the importance of white people not being defensive when they talk to other black people. The only portion, I will put the whole thing on my blog so people can read this. Check it out for their own if you want to read, share, get a better understanding of what it means to be white. I have heard this consistently from whites over the years. When you disagree and just take a stance that I do not agree with what you're saying, or I do not believe what you're saying, I think that you are being dishonest with us or being disingenuous. I think that you're practicing racism. I think Timothy Wise did this and some of our other guests. Like, how dare you have the audacity to say that you don't believe what I'm saying? Or how dare you have the audacity to call and say that you think I'm practicing racism? Who do you think you are? And to take a very haughty tone about it. That's been my experience over a number of years now in doing this program. It's almost, how dare you have the audacity to challenge me
a white person. That's the sense that it gives off to me. But I thought that was extremely appropriate. And just for the record, if you go back and listen to the program, you can hear, I think I said, I called him out at the end of the program and said I thought he was deliberately practicing racism with regards to what he said to his mom. And I called out some other responses that he gave during the broadcast, as did our listeners, that we felt did not make sense or were not accurate while he was live and direct. I think he acknowledged that in the letter. Anywho, before we get to Orlando, any quick comment on that, or can we get to the Orlando shooting?
Can I be heard?
Oh, go ahead, sis. I'll go after you.
All right, thank you. I was going to say, to be expected. I just wish he had spoke like that on the program and stopped being so deceptive. And that's all I have to say about him. Thank you.
I was going to say, this, to me, it's typical. And what I like about the letter he wrote, it's funny that I like anything, but the one thing I like is that it exposes the fact that anytime you speak to any white person about racism, white supremacy on this show or in any other context for other people who might do that in real life, they are so diseased with racism that they can't see that every aspect of their life they approach as a white supremacist. So even when they're trying to counter racism, it's from the lofty heights of I'm up here as the white supremacist, you're down there as my victim, and even in me helping you, like John Henry Clark used to say, you know, anything that the slave master does will be to their own advantage. So even when they claim to be helping you, it's going to be racist white supremacist. One of the most telling things, I picked out one sentence that he said in the letter, was that his mother was being treated unfairly. And I just took that as saying his mother was being treated like a nigger. Whenever they use the term unfairly, it means you're treating me like a nigger. You're not giving me the respect that's due to me, my mother, the respect that's due to her as a white supremacist mother. And that really stood out to me. And I think because he really went off with the four-letter words after that, too. It's just a telling sign of how white people would take their approach to everything as a white supremacist approach. And as long as we approach anything that where we're dealing with them with that understanding, we'll be okay. If you go in there trusting them or with blind faith in white people or looking for white validation, as Thomas in New York says, you're going to be in trouble. Thank you. I'll mute there.
May I be heard?
Can I be heard? Oh. Go ahead, ma'am.
I just wanted to say, wow. The guest yesterday, he really, in my opinion, worked. He was trying really hard to be a good white person, but I'm just so glad that he wrote you and you read it, so we can constantly see what good white people are like. That letter reminded me of the Tim Wise, you know, the good Tim Wise. So wow, and the fact that he said that his mom is a good woman, you know, he used that term a couple times in the letter, so I think that's interesting because he, in my opinion, was working really hard to you know, show that I'm a good white person. So, wow.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wish his quote unquote so called girlfriend really could comprehend the real person with that letter. As one of the previous callers, non-white black female, said, this is what white people do. Apparently, we did not get the honesty. I missed the program entirely, but I listened to it archive-wise up until the point he was being questioned about his sexual relationship with a victim of racism, white supremacy. This is when I observed he really started getting agitated. And in a very shrewd way, which is typical of white people, he started making more moves than Barry Sanders and Michael Jackson put together when he was being questioned about the logic behind him on one side of his mouth stating that I am no longer a racist, also admitting that we are still under a global system of racist white supremacy and having sex, therefore mistreating a non-white person. With the so-called nervous laughter, was an indicator that that the callers and the host, he understood, was getting a clear understanding of who the real person is. And this letter really just puts it out even much more clearer. That's all it does. So it's, as the, one of the callers said, it's to be expected, you know, as far as that concerned. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
So yeah, for this gentleman, I listened in during the show. I didn't comment, but for someone who is supposed to be a good person in general, white person, trying to I guess do some kind of counter racist work, I don't know how he thought that the letter that he sent you, our response, was constructive, and you know how it would be helpful to me. When someone starts talking like that, that's like violent talk. So it was totally unacceptable. I'm like counting the F words. How many times he's going to say good and then the F word. So, you know, he likes those four letter words quite a bit. But yeah, when we're talking about something like racism and all these issues, I don't know how he would think that would be of any assistance, or that would be a counter measure. Pretty much, he seems to have a problem with someone having a well thought out opinion, analysis of his relationship with this black female and the extent of which white men make sure that they defend their mothers or the white female. You can disagree with that, but you don't kind of have to have that type of violent tone and speech, which is what he sent in the letter. So I'm happy you read the letter. I say definitely put those things, post those things, make them public, because it just helps you to be aware, because it was such a front that was put up when he talked on the show, you know. And so, yeah, now we see your actual speech pattern and your thought pattern, because you did not represent that when you were on the show. So thank you again for reading this email that he sent you, on someone's email. Thank you for reading that, Gus. And I'll mute my line.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, man. I don't know what's better, the email or the show now, man. That was, to be expected, as he said. He was definitely practicing racism. And I wanted to say only in America, but I guess in South Africa, too. Can you go from going to a country, getting robbed by niggas, the next thing you know, you're hanging out in the hood 4 a.m, and next thing you know, you're sleeping with all black chicks. You know, been with her for 4 years, but, you know, I might marry her, I might have kids, I don't know. Just, you know, typical whiteness. And I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't go home and listen to the show with his black woman, and she was like, how dare he, you know, I could just see it, and you know, you better tell him something, and he got some, you know, balls, and he decided to start writing. Typical. I mean,
don't fuck you.
I thought about that, too, if he listened to it with his partner, victim of white supremacy, which he did admit during the course of the exchange yesterday, if he listened to her. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if that is the stance that she took, that, you know, who are these folks talking wild and blah, 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 and they don't know anything and you're not a racist and blah, blah, that sort of thing. That is a part of our victimization, unfortunately, which just further, if that is the case, just further illustrates the incorrectness of these tragic arrangements and why they should not happen at all under the system of white terrorism anywhere in the world. Anybody else comments on that? Are we good to move forward?
Hey, Gus, you remember the episode that you had with, I believe it was a woman from Britain, and I think her husband was with a white male, and they ended up getting pulled over, and, like, there was an assault. I think it was her brother or something. There was an assault, and something. They went to jail. You remember that episode?
There was a black female in Britain or a white?
Black female, I believe, that ended up in, like, she was going somewhere with her family. And it was a white male driver who told her, like, to get out of the car or some craziness like that. I'm trying to remember the title of it. I think there's a racist in my family, one of those episodes. But I was thinking about that particular... Do you remember that episode, Gus?
The title, I think there's a racist in my family, is very familiar. I'm just trying to remember the details of who the guest was specifically.
Oh, okay. I remember there was a British female, and it was like a big thing where they ended up, I believe, spending like a day in jail or something. It was really crazy. Excuse me. And it made me think of this woman who he is with. I'm just thinking, she must be so messed up in the head, and it's going to take an incident of that magnitude to happen to her with him, because we just saw the side of him that she hasn't seen yet, I'm pretty sure. And when it does rear its ugly head, and if it hasn't, and she's just choosing to take the abuse, that could be the case too. I don't know. I could be wrong. But if she hasn't seen that side of him, because like the female caller was saying not too long ago, he really showed who he was, and she might have been the one to egg him on, like was just previously stated, or he might have done it on his own. But the idea is that she hasn't seen that psychopathic side of him, and I could imagine what would happen when that does rear its head in a way in which she thought he was this, you know, good white man who I fell in love with, who hung out in the ghetto and all this crap, to being the terrorist that he is. And I'll mute my line.
I don't know if folks, you have to give me a moment to think, see if I can recall this specific guest that you're talking about, Roz, but I know it reminded me Jillian Shute, she was on the program twice, white woman, suspected white supremacist, and all the reason I'm saying suspect is to not name call, because she too is in a tragic arrangement. She's married to a black male. She was on a couple times previously, and if folks remember, I think it was the second time she was on, we were having a discussion. I think she had been in conversation with one of our listeners who recommended that we get her on the program. And she was saying something to the effect of he questioned her about whether or not she was working to confuse non-white people's understanding of racism by the work that she does and claiming to be anti-racist and all that. And when she was on the program, she was responding to this. And she was saying that you think that I'm trying to silence black rage and to tame black people. And I stopped her and I said, that to me, what you just said and the words that you're using, tame and to silence black rage or black anger, to me, I suspect that you're practicing racism, white supremacy. You tame animals, you tame wild beasts. I am not an animal. Black people are not animals. And that's pretty standard in terms of the way that white people talk about the way that racist white supremacists talk about black people. And the issue is not black anger. The issue is having a logical analysis of white supremacy that individuals like you, Jillian Shute, this white woman, or Christopher Clark, the guest that was with us yesterday, end up contaminating black people's logical counter-racist analyses about how we go about solving this problem. And she did the same thing. She continued to interrupt me. She started, and this was live on the program. She continued to interrupting me, and she said, I'm cursing because that's what she did. She said, oh, that's bullshit. And she kept interrupting. When I had to, tell her, I think you're practicing racism right now. You're not even allowing me to speak in terms of what you said. If you don't agree, that's fine. The same thing that I'm saying now, when you call out a white person and say, well, this, what you're doing right now, I think is an act of racism. You're not being honest or just breaking down the way that they're using words and what have you to be deceptive, to not be accurate and to confuse the way that we understand racism. When you do that, I've seen that consistently where white people get an attitude. If they were really being genuine, if they were really well-meaning whites, in my opinion, they could just sit calmly, allow you to speak. This is a Negro. We have mistreated them, even if this Negro is, you know, saying something that's crazy and is incorrect. Whatever. They're a victim of racism. I'll let them speak, and then I will, you know, give my analysis, give my response, and we can move forward. They don't even do that, which to me just further illustrates that they are practicing racism, white supremacy, and that you most likely are being accurate when you call them out for it, and they respond in that matter. And I guess my final comment would be this sort of response. This did not happen prior to me having a more accurate understanding of white supremacy, using the term white supremacy, paying attention to words, being suspicious of white people, particularly noting the massive incorrectness of whites being in any sort of sexual arrangement, any sort of sexual activity with non-white people. When I did not have that, white people never responded to me in that way, getting all upset and cursing and things like it would be the other way around. Either myself or other non-white people that I would observe, we would be the ones getting upset and frustrated and angry and cursing and all of that. And the white person says, oh, just another great day on the plantation, just having fun. I see you've got a little hot under the That would be the way things would go. And that's something that I've noted the whole time that I've been making the effort to be a bit more codified in terms of having a counter-racist analysis, that it tends to switch and be the other way around, that it's the white person who tends to get upset and emotional when you're being calm, rational, and just paying attention to the way that they use words and your understanding of racism, white supremacy, and being confident in your analysis. And they're not, you're just not going to back down or comply with what they say and just go along with the way that they are articulating racism just because they are white. You're not looking to be pals or friends or have them validate that you are an intelligent Negro under this system. I've seen that consistently and worldwide. Timothy Wise, Gillian Chute, Christopher Clark, worldwide whites in concert with how they respond. I assume everybody's good. Christopher Clark, we can move forward. Grand. Orlando shooting, I assume Donald Trump is in that as well. The female caller, you said you had commentary on Donald Trump. I don't know if it's related to Orlando, but I would suspect it probably is if it's something more recent. Did you have commentary on Donald Trump?
Yes, yes, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, right after we got finished last night, I happened to tune in to YouTube. Donald Trump, who was walking in to give his feel on the Pulse nightclub shooting. And he really went at it. Some people even looked at him to be very presidential at this point. He was saying that, and these are his words, of course, that we cannot continue to allow thousands of people to come into the country with the same thought process as the savage killer. And many of the principles of radical Islam are incompatible with Western values and institutions. They're anti-gay, anti-women, anti-American. And we, I guess referring to white supremacy, we need to tell the truth about radical Islam. And then he went on to tell Hillary Clinton that she needs to tell, that she bears the burden of telling us why we should allow these people in and how she plans to pay for it. So he really, really went at it last night from start to finish. And I know it really shook the White House, if not, you know, most people throughout the world who was tuning in his speech, because he was very aggressive in his tone as well. That's what I wanted to share. Well, actually, what you said last night, Tommy, you said something to the effect that something like this was to happen in this country, that it would probably put him in the forefront of becoming the president. So I think you're 100% correct. Thank you.
Oh, for sure, for sure. There has been a lot of pushback from what I've seen from more mainstream coverage. I know the Washington Post, the New York Times, some of the other mainstream outlets, they were talking about Donald Trump's speech yesterday about all of this, and he made sure, damn you, Obama, made sure to get his jabs in at President Obama and said, this is your fault. You've allowed all this. You're being weak. You're being soft. A lot of the same language that they've used over the years. You're incompetent in how to deal with the threat of Muslim terrorists, Islamic extremists, that you just have not dealt with this problem adequately. You've allowed all these no-good savages to flood into this area of the world, and or it could be worse than that, and he kind of left it in that he didn't explicitly state what he meant, that it could be something more than that. And a lot of people took that as he was suggesting that maybe he is a covert Muslim, as many, many people have suggested, many white people have suggested over the last 8 years, that maybe he is really a Muslim from Kenya who is allowing his Muslim brothers to come in and do this on purpose. But it was a lot of pushback and saying, oh, my gosh, this rhetoric, and I can't believe that he would take this opportunity to sound this way. They had quite a few reports, both there and NPR as well. They had a report that was pretty much saying the same thing. I can give you the title of it really quick. But in all of that, while I'm getting the general gist of it, was that they were saying that, oh, my gosh, he does not sound presidential in at all in terms of how he is responding to this event, that this is the same hyped up rhetoric that we've been asking him to calm down on. And in my opinion, this was just more white deception, just more white people lying. If you were not paying attention to the response post 9/11 back in 2001, George Bush did the exact same thing. I remember, what did he say? What did they say in the Westerns? Dead or alive? We are going over there to get these savages, and everybody rallied around. Oh, I won't say everybody, but the vast majority of white people rallied around that. Let's do it. We're going to Iraq. We're going to Afghanistan. We are going to get these sand niggas and make it happen. Boom, boom, boom. And any white people that don't like it, you can get it too. That was the exact attitude. His approval rating spiked. It was tons of white people that were disgusted with George Bush. They felt he had stole the 2000 election, that he shouldn't even be president, and they were furious with him. Those buildings went down. The Pentagon got hit. He came out and made his speech about, we're not going to tolerate this, and we're going after these folks. It was on and popping. Everybody loves George. I said, this is the exact same thing. What are you talking about, that we're not going with this rhetoric? They have, the blueprint is already there. This is not ancient history. I have seen this before. I know how white people respond to this sort of thing, particularly if any sort of suggestion that this was dark people, and you went right now, the darling LGBT people. Oh, my gosh, they are going to roll with this. I am totally... It went up. I've been talking the whole time about my confidence slowly increasing. Huge jump. I've been just president-elect Donald Trump, president-elect Donald Trump. I'm almost at the point of saying I think this is a done deal. He has got this. Obviously, a lot of things could happen between now and November, but lots of folks, I said this yesterday, lots of people had been saying before this, they had been, and I mean when they had been saying this months ago, they had been saying this back in wintertime, if anything like this happens, Donald Trump is going to be in the White House come 2017. I think they were correct. I could be in error. We'll see how things go. It's a lot of months before we get to November, but I think they're totally wrong, and I think they're lying on top of it. The white people have the audacity to come out and say that he's just coming with all this inflammatory rhetoric, and this is not how we need to respond. They're lying. They know that this is going to go great. White people are going to roll. Let's get that wall up. Let's keep these sand niggas out of the country. Let's bomb somebody. Let's rock and roll. That's how we get down. I will hush. Other folks have commentary?
One thing that is enjoyed in this part of the world that's called the United States, so-called, is fun and play. Nightclub scene, big ball games, especially professional ball games. So it still is a lot of time for something similar to what took place a couple of days ago to happen again, even at a larger magnitude, although it doesn't have to be a larger magnitude, just anything that it's similar to it. And in turn, as was spoken, it will support Mr. Trump from the standpoint of, quote unquote, I told you so. And one thing about white people is that when you go in the voters booth,
no matter what you say out in public or with someone else, especially talking to a non-white black person, you actually can vote in favor of that fear factor that white person would have over this issue. And so Dr. Wilson's prediction could very well come true. I wouldn't say surprising, but it is sort of agitating, but I understand it. It is sort of agitating to me for to hear all of these, a lot of non-white black people think that there is something dramatically different if Mrs. Clinton becomes the president. It's like comparing, comparing two negatives, to think that something good is going to come out, on our behalf, by picking someone other than Mr. Trump, that sort of thing. But, this definitely is something that was, be in his favor, would definitely be in his favor. And I appreciate the good point that came up about the pictures of the people who actually were murdered. The overwhelming majority of them were non-white people. And that is very much significant, but yet I haven't heard it from a quote-unquote mainstream outlet yet. Has anybody else heard about that? I would be curious to know. Did they hear the race factor on this issue that took place in Orlando?
Only NPR, they did point out that about half of the victims were Puerto Rican, even though Puerto Rican is not a race. And
right.
Al Jazeera, they did have an op-ed piece where they pointed that out. In fact, they made a contrast in saying that it was more, I think they used the term people of color, but non-white people that were killed in this incident, as opposed to the incident in California where there was an armed suspect, I believe he was a white person, where he was stopped at a gay pride parade in California. He was heavily armed and they stopped him, so nobody was injured, nobody was harmed, and he felt that it was greater value of white life at the event in California that allowed that to be stopped where nothing happened, whereas opposed mostly non-white people at this club in Florida where you had all this massive carnage.
Mm-hmm.
May I be heard?
Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I did see it was on CNN, I believe, where they had one of the victims who was shot. She was a black female, and she said that she heard the gunman say that this was not, he didn't have a problem with black people. He wanted to know, who in the, who was black that, was in the club, I guess, and she was afraid to speak up, but then he was saying that he doesn't have a problem with black people. They have suffered enough, and he was doing this to get America to stop bombing his country. I also think it's interesting that, because she said that she heard him make the 911 call, but they haven't released the 911 call. And the female's name that they have interviewed who has said this, her name is Patience Carter. So it was on all the, I'm sure if you Google it, because they have her picture up, but she did say that he mentioned that he didn't have a problem with black people. So I thought that was interesting. And of course, this is about racism, white supremacy. And I thought that was interesting that this was being aired today.
Let me we have people that I don't think commented before. The person 4693.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I had missed the guest earlier, and the lady that just spoke just asked a question that I was going to ask. But I wanted to ask a question to you because my question was going to be how you feel about
white man kind of brainwashed that
it's a bit hard to hear you. It's a bit hard to hear you. Can you ask your question again?
So I was saying that my question was going to be to the guest was that how does she feel about white men brainwashing Asian women to think that white men are better? Are kind of brainwashing the Asian world to think more Western.
Oh, okay.
And I also was gonna ask her how does she feel about anime, because racism kind of plays out in Asian anime when they have the characters look more Caucasian, whereas, you know what I'm saying, looking Asian himself. But that's all I was gonna ask. I mean, if she's gone, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Right on. I guess we've done our time on that segment. Folks had commentary on the Orlando Donald Trump thing. Appreciate your caller just trying to make sure people had comments they wanted to make sure they got in related to the shooting that took place. The caller at 1902, did you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
No, I was just listening. It was great. I had caught the podcast yesterday. I didn't listen to it live. So to hear it all play out about the letter earlier, that was wow. But to the whole Donald Trump thing and just President Obama, I don't know if I like the fact that he had to address Trump, but, you know, I guess, you know, he had to address because he's a figure now. But I still go back to, you know, the whole Obama effect about how whites reacted to seeing a black person. Dr. Welsing talked about it, you know, this black person in this high-ranking job, and they react. And I'll be honest, and you kind of said it earlier, Gus, you're feeling it, and I've been feeling it, that Trump is moving. The powers to be are going to make this happen. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to be, you know, as a scare tactic, but I just, you know, you can see the things line up. You know, I don't know if they want a white woman there, if a white man would put a white woman there before Trump. I mean, you know, Obama, you know, they consider him a gimmick. They consider him a gimmick from day one. That's where the whole Sarah Palin McCain came out. You know, she was a gimmick, you know. You know, if he can get in, then Sarah Palin can get in, okay? So that didn't work. So we have an ultimate gimmick, and white people are following in rows. So I got the Trump effect. I'll be honest. Like, I have it. So I'm not saying I'm going to try to emulate, you know, I'm going to really get into, you know, the numbers of that, what had happened there. And I'm going to really, because I'm feeling it, because I see how people at work talk about it, you know, and it's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, a guy, I'm walking out of work and guy goes, you know, his people, Obama's on CNN and we're in the break room. He, you know, it's his people. You're like, what are you talking about? It's his people. Like, what does that mean? You know what I mean? Like, he's not Muslim. Like, what are you talking about? But it's just how people think. I'm just going to say people. I mean, because, you know, I had it the same day, a black guy was, you know, talking about, I don't look at it like that. And he talking to another white guy. He just nodded, headed to two Ford truck drivers. And, you know, I don't look at it. We got problems. We shooting our own people. And I'm just looking at him side his head like, you know. So it's just, you know, I like I said, the Trump effect is on for me. I'm getting it. And so if you are upstanding, you didn't get caught in the system, and you can take care of yours, you need to take care of yours. Seriously, I'll mute my line.
For sure, for sure. The person at 0748, did you have commentary? Yes, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to say I have been seeing some news segments at our local station, And I noticed, like, they had at the city hall downtown, they had a LGBT, I guess, like, ceremony. And it was definitely a white-dominated, you know, everybody holding candles. And I think they did, like, a 15-minute segment, took up, like, 50% of the news, the whole news, 30 minutes, like, saying, you know, hey, we got, it was a lot of white people donating blood, and I just seen, like, a huge white presence speaking on an incident where a lot of non-white people were harmed. And I just think that's just, like, carefully orchestrated by the most powerful white people. And I just think we can connect that to Donald Trump and say, see, well, you know, I like the so-called Latinos. See, I'm coming out and this about another group, you know, that they like to call terrorists and Muslims. See, not don't vote for me. It just seems like it's very premeditated. And there was a Facebook post where they were saying, I guess, two other people got away. Like, he might have had some help holding the door, or like it was other people on the scene. So I just think, you know, the races are very powerful with how they can interpret a story, and they, you know, definitely can deceive you, you know, and they won't tell the whole truth, but they can make it seem and appear as though it is true. You know, they can just say, well, you know, he had a profile on a dating site. They can just characterize the guy any way they want. But it's very powerful how they can interpret it. And the races seem to win once again. So that's all I have.
Can I be heard?
Oops, I was muted. I was just going to ask really quick, man, before you commented. I was going to say, has anybody heard the word forgiveness mentioned at all in connection with this event, even one time? Has anybody heard that word mentioned?
Oh no.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all.
Me either. I have checked BBC. I checked Al Jazeera. I checked Alex Jones. I hate him too. I checked Democracy Now, NPR, local outlets, the Orlando Sentinel, Seattle Times. I've seen Fox News, NBC. Not one time have I heard anyone say the word forgiveness or forgive. The female caller, we could hear you. Did you want to speak?
Hi, it's Lady again. I didn't know if anyone heard or read any articles about this shooting. There were two interesting ones that I came across. One, when it first happened, stating that he was pushed into the club. I don't really understand that, or how he was pushed in the club. And then today I was reading a local paper, but the article was in USA Today, and it stated that some of the injuries and deaths may have been caused by police opening fire and not all by the shooter. It was stating in the article how, you know, it was a crowd of over 300 and it was a complex layout. And it just was just giving some details about how they were, what type of force they were using to get him out. You know, long story short, they pretty much said that, yeah, we're investigating because we could have killed some of these people too. So I don't know if anyone saw that on any local news stations, but that's what I read in the paper today.
I for myself, didn't really have to see it anywhere. Automatically, when you have assault rifles of that potential, and it's a multiple amount of people shooting, that you're bound to hit more than just that one person. If it's not if it's not from a standpoint of ricochet, not really directly aiming at a quote-unquote innocent person. That type of thing always had a possibility of happening, especially in a situation similar to that. I wouldn't be surprised. Of course, that'd be found out. It could be found out through autopsies on the victims.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say, Gus, I find something very telling about the way the news report is going. Like I said earlier, they're calling out the fact that this guy is Islamic, which would imply a non-white person. They're not speaking of his history of being in gay bars from what they said in interviews that they had with people who knew him personally. And I find it very telling that they're not really talking too much about the race of the people that died, because I find if the vast majority of those people were white, we would have seen their pictures a lot quicker, and they would have made that known. I think it's because they're not mostly non-white, is that they're using the term LGBT, and also I think it's like a way of making them honorary whites in death, and at the same time perpetuating the lifestyle, because they're focusing on the lifestyle, not the actual people and their color. And I just found that very telling, because with the shooter, they're calling them all kind of Islamic and associating him with terrorism and all this other stuff. So you already know they're speaking of a non-white person. But with the people that died, they're just going by their sexual orientation and not really focusing on the race. And that's coming out very late, I would say. And I just find that very interesting.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
I just have one more thought. Everybody, just look at the confusion. The guy was supposedly gay, had kids, and, you know, and he hung out at the bar. I mean, he hung out at this club, and it's just, he was so confused. And what made him confused? You know, and it's just, it has to be the system. I mean, to be confused like that, to not know, and then kill the people that you like. If you want to be that way, fine. But to have that in your brain, it doesn't make any sense. That's the only thing I got from the whole thing, was how confused the system will make you to where you will react in such a way, you know. And then, like you said, how the media is covering it, you know, he's American born. You know, he worked for a security company. He had the training. Went and bought the rifles and whatever he needed without trouble. They talked to him twice and still didn't. It doesn't make sense, you know. And watch, you mark my words, the gay community will get a lot of concessions because of this sacrifice. And it's Mr. Fuller all the way. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yeah, I find this very, very suspicious, because the lady was saying earlier that about him making a comment about black people, about not wanting to harm black people. But I've also read an article that says that he spoke also derogatorily about black people. Also, the interview that FBI did in 2013 and 14, and the fact that he worked for this major defense company that's based in Britain. And I know that the FBI also, quote-unquote, radicalized people at times. So I find this whole thing very, very suspicious. Plus, it's like every day coming up with something new. First, he was homophobic. Now they're saying he's going to gay bars. This thing is... they're trying to push the agenda out. That's what I think. This is trying to push the agenda out. I don't know what the agenda is, but I know this is agenda-driven, and that's what I have to say. Thank you.
The person that called in 0827, did you have a commentary?
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody.
You're a little low. If you could speak up, give us a little bit more volume, please.
Yeah, can you hear me better now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So
I'm not sure if anybody has seen this, but the Daily Mail actually tweeted out a collage of the victims. And, of course, the one black female in the bunch, they used her mugshot. Not that we needed further evidence of the tackiness of white people, but, yeah, I just wanted to add that. I'll make my line.
Can I be heard?
Go ahead, sir.
Oh, I just wanted to state that now the focus is going on the wife, but I even get confused about that because at one point in time, I'm hearing the term ex-wife, and at the same time, I'm also hearing wife. Now, had this person been married twice, or are they talking about the same person?
She's married twice.
Okay, okay, well... yeah, they are putting the focus on her, and I could be wrong, but I wouldn't be surprised if she gets arrested. I would not be surprised if she gets arrested because they're stating that that she possibly may have she probably could have prevented this from happening, and maybe the reason why I'm bringing it up because maybe from that arrest. Possible arrest or the further questioning. I know they're questioning her probably as we speak, that more of what actually was the reasoning and circumstances behind this this situation would be better known from someone who is close to the killer. She may have some interesting things to hear. That's it.
I did see a report today that she was being, his second wife, that she was being looked at with greater scrutiny. They were saying that she was being uncooperative, quote unquote. So, yeah, I would not be surprised at all if she ends up being arrested or something happens because they have been saying that over the last 24 hours. Thomason?
Sorry.
I was just, Thomas in New York, I thought you spoke up. Were you going to comment?
Yes, I was. If you needed someone else to speak, I can wait, so.
Proceed.
I'll be really brief. I was just going to say he has his ex-wife that he was with 8 years ago who she claims he abused her and her family got her away from him, and then his current wife who they say he has two children by. And also they're saying that from what I've seen in the reports that she tried to talk him out of the shooting. So if they do arrest her, it might be under the pretext that he informed you you were going to go to the club and do the shooting and you did not call the authorities. You tried to talk him out of it. And if she is being uncooperative, that's going to just make her situation worse.
I was just going to say, you know, when this whole incident first happened, I looked at it and I was watching it. And my wife said, you know, what do you think about this? And I just said that they came up with this whole little, you know, ISIS. First thing I said was Donald Trump is going to eat this up, man. If I'm his campaign manager, I'm telling him, start tweeting. But second, I was saying, you know, they just came out with the information too fast. You know, first it was that he was a member of ISIS. Then it was his father said that he saw two men kissing and it made him angry and this, that, and the other, and they gave an interview to the father. But now you come to find out that he was gay this whole time. And that's what I told my wife. I said, I wouldn't be surprised if his, you know, his boyfriend was in the club or something and he went up in there and shot it up. So, you know, but I just think that they're going to use this to their advantage. I don't see how this could be labeled a hate crime if he was gay. I just want to see how that whole thing plays out. I don't know how they're going to spin that now. And I'm not convinced that he was a member of ISIS either, but I'm sure that this will definitely be something that Trump hammers home. And unfortunately, all the Democrats are going to keep saying is he need more gun control. And, you know, so this, what I want to know, and this is what I wanted to add is, I think the telltale event that will happen will be another police shooting that brings a huge outrage like a Ferguson or a Baltimore, not even on that scale, but that would be the telltale to see how Trump will respond to that. What would he say if something like that happens? You know, that's what I'm waiting for, and I think that will definitely happen this summer. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Oh yeah, to give more evidence on whether or not this person was quote unquote gay, I would figure that someone would have to come forward to say that they had intimacies with the murderer. I kind of like don't see that happening because from there they would be under heavy scrutiny as far as, you know, about the crime itself, or did you know any, did he talk about this and all that kind of stuff? And I don't see no one wanting to go through that right now because it is very heavily pressured atmosphere, you know, from that standpoint. So it probably would never get solid on or whether or not he would definitely be marked down as being quote unquote gay, because I can see where no one would actually come out and state that they had relations with him because of the investigative pursuit that would go directly to that person. It was something else that I had to say, but I can't think about it right now. Maybe I'll mention it once I remember it. Thank you.
The strange thing to me about the whole racial implications, and like Gus said, and Neely Fuller said, the only race is the white race. Because I live in Harlem, and we have Arabs that own all the stores. And if I was to go and grab up all the Arabs from the store, and put them in some, you know, jeans, put them in a shirt, and put a Yankee hat on them, and drop them over to East Harlem, the Spanish Harlem, everybody would swear they was Puerto Rican anyway. So I don't, you know, really catch the whole race thing with that.
They are interviewing a obvious-looking black male to say that he corresponded on a somewhat consistent basis with the killer. It's always this, I'm looking at it right now, it's always this black male that they are interviewing on this subject that corresponded with him because he was on these quote unquote gay websites. So that's an interesting factor into this, that out of all of the people that comes out as far as some kind of gay connection, it's a non-white black male that they are constantly interviewing on that.
They work very hard between gay and black, very close together.
Yeah.
Any other folks had comments they wanted to make sure they got in? Everyone?
I just wanted to say that. Oh, hello?
Yes, ma'am. Proceed.
I was saying that white guy in that was California. He had explosives and guns and all that stuff. I think he also they said was gay also. So I don't know how they're saying this is like a hate crime if these people are supposed to be gay. I don't see how they're gonna make it work.
I think it was a hate crime. They consider it terrorism. It's a hate crime.
You know what I found telling too, Gus? The fact that when the shooting happened in South Carolina, President Obama did not call it an act of terrorism. And with this incident, he immediately called it an act of terrorism. Like, instantaneously, it was like, it wasn't even the next day. Like, that night, he actually called it an act of terrorism. And I just found that very interesting as well.
Also, be advised, the president will be in Orlando, I think, Thursday. I believe it's Thursday.
Did he go to Charleston right away? No.
He went for the memorial, the service for Reverend Clement de Pinckney. I don't think he was there before the memorial service, though.
Okay, well, at least he didn't fly over it, you know, like Katrina, you know. But I just think that, you know, Millie Fuller said, you know, this gay thing was going to change everything, and I think we're seeing it play out, and it's playing out really fast, really quick, and this is going to make all kinds of new laws and penalties and protections, and you know, it's just going to be more confusion.
Have you guys seen the article that's calling it the LGBT's Charleston?
No, say that again, ma'am.
They've been calling it the LGBT Charleston massacre. This is the LGBT Charleston.
Wow. Not surprised. Not surprised.
Wow.
That's done on purpose. Also, right after the incident, as everyone would call, they were in unison singing "We Shall Overcome" also.
Yeah, gay is becoming the new black. Like, they have that dumb show, Orange is the New Black. That's exactly what they're doing. And I believe that's why they really focused on the sexual orientation of the victims and not their ethnicity or anything to indicate that they were non-white people until so long after the incident.
I'm glad firefighters said that. When I saw the gay people marching, singing, "We Shall Overcome Someday," I said, oh, my God, like, this is, like, what y'all think, y'all, Reverend King now? Like, man, I mean, the level of confusion black people going to have, especially if they think they're going to be accepted the same way being gay is, what, I mean, it's just going to, like, this is terrible what's going on. And I really hope that it does come out that this wasn't no hate crime, that this was just a lovely squabble. He was mad. He went and shot. I mean, anything other than a hate crime, because, I mean, you can't even say the word, you know, certain words anymore. I mean, it's going to be, they're going to be treated like we should have all these years. I mean, you're going to see how they enforce the civil rights laws the right way. I mean, everything that should have happened for us, we're going to see happen for these white gay men. Like, they need civil rights, white people. It's just ridiculous.
There's that report, I'm sure it's probably more than one, but the report that was mentioned, this is Our Charleston. It's PBS, so this is a major news report. This is Our Charleston, Orlando LGBT Center mourns massacre victims. That's the title of the report at PBS. I'll share the article if folks want to check that out. Also thought of... Go ahead.
I was going to ask with the incident that took place in Charleston, was any money donated towards the victims? And if so, can anybody from like, let's say, money donated from a large corporation? Has anybody can recall any money donated in that way from a large corporation to the families of the murder victims in Charleston?
I don't know about large corporation, but there was a lot of money donated, because that even became an issue about how they were going to divvy it up amongst the victims. When I say a lot, like millions that was donated. And I heard a report recent, like within the last month, that they ended up divvying up the millions amongst the family members. But I did see that there was. I don't know about large corporation.
Okay. The reason why I brought up, because I'm looking at right now ticker tape from looking at the news that Disney World has donated over $1 million to the victims of the Orlando situation. I'm just trying to make a check and make a comparison out of the two. Because I'm just gonna say I'm looking at the news and listening to the program at the same time. So, go ahead.
I saw a report recently that it showed that it said that the family members of the Charleston massacre terrorist act, they were going to sue the church for keeping some of the money, and they were able to settle without a lawsuit. And that came on the news. I could probably YouTube and find it if I really try. But that was like probably on CNN or MSNBC where I saw that report.
I was going to say I saw that that they had gotten, so far they had amassed, I believe it was $5.3 million for the victims of this particular shooting in Orlando. It was an article that popped up on my phone a little earlier this evening.
I would say, I know Mr. Fuller was mentioned, my opinion, if you are a black person and you are sounding as though you are not empathetic about what happened with this event and you have a problem with this being called their Charleston or something to that effect, you are probably going to be chided immediately and probably even by a significant number of black people as being a homophobe and you're the type of person that made this possible. I would strongly suspect that that's the sort of thing that is going to happen if you're seeming like you are not with this, or even if you just have questions, not even if you're, you know, certainly not saying anything to suggest that anything was correct about this, even if you're saying that this was incorrect, that it was an act of terrorism, but just asking questions and submitting that, you know, the system of white supremacy is most to blame for something like this and that racists might have even had some sort of role in coordinating all of this, I would be mindful that that is probably what's going to happen. You're going to be, you're a homophobe and that sort of thing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Anything that can be considered counter-racist does not have a substantial foundation, but yet the global system of racism and white supremacy has a very solid foundation. And so, therefore, any confusing situation in its description can be brought our way as victims, and it can further confuse any efforts of non-white people, especially non-white black people, to be confused on solving the problem. And that's what we are experiencing as of right now. Based on what I'm hearing, based on what I'm saying, as far as the we shall overcome and the different things that sound similar to black people getting mistreated, but nevertheless, it's another cause altogether that ends up confusing, therefore harming the means for this problem to be solved.
Absolutely. I also thought it was significant. If folks had anything they wanted to make sure they get in, you should get your hand up now if you had other comments or if you hadn't dialed in. I think him working for one of the major security firms in the world, G4S, I think that was mentioned before, where their international headquarters is in the UK, as I understand it. I would think you would have to go not just a background check, but like regular background checks, like on a, if not annual basis, this would have to be something that's ongoing to make sure that you haven't done something, been arrested for something, that sort of thing. If you're going to have a job as security, they've been saying, at least some of the reports that I saw, that you would have to be armed in some of these instances. They said he did security at one of the courthouses. They also said he did security at a gated retirement community. And he had been interviewed multiple times, more than once, by the FBI. I mean, that is just stunning to me that this person would be able to pass background checks and allowed to have this security job and be able to have a firearm in doing all of that and carrying out his duties. And this doesn't pop up on somebody's radar. This doesn't even pop up to where he should be fired from this security job. That just to me stands out as being extremely suspicious, something that to me seems like something that would be direct involvement of racist white supremacists and how they can orchestrate something like this. I know just my understanding of racism, white supremacy, if you are a black person and you are on a job, I imagine it would be pretty difficult if you get called in and you have to be interviewed twice by the FBI or any other enforcement agency with allegations that you might be a terrorist or affiliated to a terrorist or something of that nature. It doesn't even have to be a terrorist. You got dirty fingernails or whatever, and you get to keep your job. I just don't see that happening for the typical black person, typical victim of racism. That, to me, stands out as extremely suspicious. And if you're working for a security firm, it would seem that whites would know a lot about you. That just stood out to me as being significant how all of this is covered.
Oh, last but not least, this is what I forgot that's being talked about a whole lot, even from the inception of this event, that this is the worst, quote-unquote, mass shooting in the history of America. I believe that's exactly how it's been pronounced. Wasn't a lot of black people shot in Tulsa, Oklahoma? Wasn't a lot of black people shot and killed in Rosewood, the Rosewood part of Florida? And how can one be so accurate, at least the way it's been sounding, about this issue being the worst mass shooting in the history of America? I kind of like questioning that. How can they be so confident and accurate in their so-called accuracy on that when it comes to mistreatment of clearly non-white black people? That's kind of like an open question if anybody would care to answer that question. Thank you.
You know, what else stood out for me is I saw the clip or the video of the whole thing. And the police went in, and you hear a bunch of shots, and, you know, they apparently hit him. And just from a few incidents that's happened in crowded areas of New York City where there's been shooting, a lot of the bystanders were hit with police bullets. And inside of a crowded club, I would find it quite illogical that none of those police bullets didn't hit any of the so-called victims of this crime, as well as, you know, the carnage he already inflicted. It was too many shots that went off for none of those to ricochet, hit something, splash somewhere, you know, my Kai Gurley, you know, hit the wall, bounce off, or however it may happen. And for them to say that this one person did all of this, I just don't think that's logical.
The people that dialed in, I'm just making sure we didn't miss anybody. 4950. 4950, did you have commentary? Are you just listening?
Yes. I actually wanted to speak on the whole security aspect. I did work for G4S. I was converted from a company called Ally Barton. Ally Barton had lost the contact with Amazon building. G4S had taken over. When they taken over, I do not recall them doing a background check. So that could have been something that happened. I'm not sure in his situation, but again, like I don't recall them doing a background screening on most of the people that got converted over. And then when you do security, you have to go through, and I know in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, you have to go through so much just to get access to firearms. You have to do certain trainings, and then you have to do like a secondary background check. But I'm not sure about where he is. In Pennsylvania, once you go through these screenings, if you get in trouble if you get a speeding ticket, that will come up. That could jeopardize your job. So him being investigated by the FBI, I'm not sure why G4S didn't pick up on that and look into his activities. But that was all I had to say.
Hear, 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 hear.
Any of the other folks who dialed in more recently, just checking to make sure we didn't miss anybody. The caller at 5992, caller at 4693. Did y'all have any comments you wanted to get in before we wrap? The caller at 9516.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Man, this is a sir. I'm sorry.
Oh, my bad. My bad. My bad.
Yeah. Did any of you all hear about how Donald Trump was trying to tie Obama in with the attack in the Orlando shooting, saying that he's not manly, he's weak. This man who is running our country is showing more concern about the religion of these terrorists than he has ties. Any of you all hear that?
Yes, sir.
And the sad thing is that whenever you speak up against white supremacy, you know what I'm saying? They kind of try and tie you in with, you know what I'm saying, the people who they declared a international terrorist against them. It's almost like the darker the skin, the more terrorist you are. Never mind the fact how Dylan killed 9 people in South Carolina. Never in the history of America has any of America's political leaders went out their way to. I'm sorry, it's my phone. Sorry. Never in the history of America had any of the political leaders went on a national outcry about any black person who was killed. Hillary Clinton went on a national outcry. Donald Trump, Obama. But what about the people in Charleston, South Carolina? What about them? Why hasn't Hillary said much? Why hasn't Donald Trump said anything? Mind you, this happened around the time he was running for president. The sad thing is that this country has always been for gay life. This country has always been for non-black life. But, I mean, the sad thing is this country has shown little concern about black life. And even when people say all lives matter, that's enough to indicate that your life don't matter. Especially when the group of people who are classified as black don't even have constitutional rights. And I find it redundant that they would say that the shooting in Orlando is the most deadliest massacre that the U.S. has ever faced. When, like the other caller said before, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, they said that the body count in Tulsa, Oklahoma was 300. But when you have to depend on white people to count the bodies, of course the numbers are going to be off. They said that it has been as much as 3,000 bodies. And they just swept that under the rug. I don't understand that. It's like whenever something happens to white people or something happens to quote-unquote LGBT people, they go on this national outcry. And that's sad because black people are dying in the streets every day. And they are somehow trying to say black crime is some sort of genetic. They're trying to link black crime to genetics. Like, it's just because they're black. They say it's because of family values, but what they're really trying to say is because they're black. That's the sad thing. So,
we'll leave it there. I just wanted to check and make sure we didn't miss anybody else. The other folks who had comments, they wanted to make sure they got in before we get ready to wrap things up. Anybody else?
Yeah. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just want to say, while I was looking at mainstream news earlier, and I generally don't do that, but I want to see or hear their comments, and they was taking emphasis off terrorism outside the country or whatever and putting it on people who own guns in America, or they need more gun policies and this, that, and the other, instead of just saying, you know, the United States and Israel, they break international laws, go around the world, terrorize people, and you know, not to expect that people is not going to react is just ridiculous. And as far as Donald Trump and his comments about, you know, savages, I just have to shake my head. no one's more savage than white supremacy. It's just unbelievable how they can say that. Like they don't go around terrorizing and killing people just because they can do it. And so for him to call other people savages is just a joke, because his ancestors came from Europe, you know. So, you know, they were definitely savages since the time they came on this soil. So I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Other commentary, folks. This also, in addition to bumping the one-year anniversary of Charleston, which, you know, nobody has anything to say about that at all now, also bumped O.J. Made in America, which I'm sure was going to get lots and lots of attention. And now that, too, has been kicked to the curb. I can't say I'm upset about that, because we certainly have had enough O.J. coverage over the last 20 years. Anybody else have commentary they wanted to get on the shooting in Orlando before we wrap up?
Chris Kyle always also use savages to describe average people.
Who?
Mr. Chris Kyle.
Not sure.
American Sniper. They would call them savages.
Oh, Chris Kyle got it. People. Yes, he did.
Oh, guys, I was just going to say they had a brief article from NBC News that said that the U.S. law enforcement officers had, Omar Mateen's wife had told U.S. law enforcement officers that she tried to stop her husband from carrying out his bloody attack on an Orlando gay club. It has been reported. Noor Salman, age 30, said to have been with Mateen when he bought ammunition and a holster as he prepared for the attack that murdered 49 people. She also drove him out to Pulse, the gay club, so he could scope it out. Federal Bureau of Investigation sources told sources familiar with the case told NBC News. And they said that she's also cooperating with authorities, so they haven't made a final decision whether they're going to charge her with anything at this time.
Whether she was scared or not. You know what I'm saying? If she was afraid that he was going to kill her. You know, they don't ever ask that. They don't ever give non-white victims the benefit of the doubt. Surely if the shooter was white and his wife was white, they wouldn't have tried to convict her of anything. And I said, maybe she was scared. You know, maybe she was going to tell him, but she was afraid of what might would happen to her. They don't ever give white female victims the benefit of the doubt. I mean, non-black, non-white female victims the benefit of the doubt. Like they do white females. This double standard is a sin.
Last but not least, I have a feeling that starting with large police departments, they're going to the everyday police officer is going to be issued a new toy, a standard AR-15, to be added to what they carry around. And of course, we know that firearm is going to be used directly against us for the most part.
That's what they say he smuggled into the club. They said it was it had a shortened stock and a chopped off barrel, but it was an AR-15 and another weapon.
Yeah.
But the AR-15.
Now he was trying to say it was
MXX,
233 something.
Yeah, from my understanding, that's the size of the bullet with the firearm, the 223. And from my understanding, he shot his way into the club, which is very possible when you have an assault rifle. You would know the sound that it makes, and it is much more frightening than any pistol that you can have. You will get out of the way of it. And it was a enforcement official that was working in the front of the building, off duty, overtime, as security. And he did return fire, but I'm pretty sure that he cut and ran in order to save his own life. Because pistol versus assault rifle is no competition.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm sure there'll be lots more information and disinformation coming out over the next hours, days, what have you. We certainly have more time to discuss all of this in the coming days. Just be alert as you can if you find anything. I'm going to post that. See, I'm going to post the article. This is Our Charleston, the quote-unquote LGBT community. I'll post that on the Facebook page. I'll tweet it as well so folks can check that out. I think the report that was mentioned earlier about the black victim who said that, you know, the shooter said that he was going to spare her because black people had suffered enough. I think I shared that one already. Folks want to check it out. If you find anything else, feel free to drop an email. If you find anything that you think we should review or pay attention to, just let us know. We'll try and catch as much info as possible. Tons out there already and more to come next few hours and days. Again, we should be here Thursday, workplace racism. I'm sure this will be coming up and being discussed on the job, so be prepared in terms of what you want to say, not say, and being mindful in terms of being branded as a homophobe, which they are quick to do to black people worldwide. Just be mindful of that and how you respond to all this, if they perceive that you're not being empathetic enough or that you have too many questions about what happened, that sort of thing, or that you're not sad enough about all of this. Just keep that in mind as we go about responding to this. But we'll be here on Thursday, Workplace Racism, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That'll be Thursday evening. Again, if you have one piece, just one like rule or regulation from policy and procedure on your job, share, and it can be something that you did not know, something significant on your job that you did not know, either can be something constructive or non-constructive. If it's something, a policy that is not routinely enforced, that is routinely flouted on the job, just anything, one specific aspect of the policy and procedure on your job that stands out, if you could bring that to share on Thursday, I think that would be constructive. Medical apartheid, that'll be this coming Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We're on part 9, Harriet Washington, medical apartheid. Phenomenal read. Hope folks are getting constructive information. Compensatory calling will be Saturday, and the global Sunday talk on racism, that'll be coming up this Sunday. Will be great to hear non-white people in other parts of the world what they think about this, what has been reported in their part of the world, how this is being talked about in their respective quote-unquote countries. That'll be Sunday, normal time for that program. It's obviously earlier, is 12 noon Eastern, 11 a.m. Central, 9 a.m. Pacific. That is this Sunday, so we should be here every day, Thursday through Sunday. Dr. Rasayan will be with us next week as well. Be good to get his thoughts on how all of this has transpired and the impacts, the ramifications that this will have moving forward. If you have gripes, complaints, guest suggestions, if you can't find something in the archives or just a general question, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. We're on Twitter as well @untiljustice. You can hit us on Facebook also. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who tuned in. Hope you got something constructive out of the exchange with Miss Kathy Dang, and then thoughts on what's happened in Orlando. Certainly we'll talk about that more as this week progresses, and also revisiting what Christopher Clark had to share with us yesterday. Tackiness abounds. I am going to post that article on my blog, so you can check it out if you want to revisit that. With that, the incident in Orlando certainly should make it clear, if we needed another painful illustration, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. It is constant warfare worldwide. We need to be
cognizant of that at all times. Let's make sure that our behavior reflects that. Whites are at war with us. Certainly, if you're going to be out and about as it gets warm for the summer months, you want to be codified at all times, regardless whether you're if you're in a vehicle as a driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian. You do not want to be under the influence. We want to be able to make phenomenal decisions at all times to keep ourselves as safe as possible. Certainly, if you're in contact with an enforcement official, even if it's just a regular old John Doe white citizen, it can be a lethal encounter in seconds. Keep that in mind. Sobriety would be best. And even as Dr. Cambon has said consistently, as victims of white supremacy, really, we want to make sure that we are in the house. 11, 12 o'clock, if you're outside, bad things can happen. That's not putting blame on the victim. That's just we are in an extremely toxic, dangerous, racist planet, and that we should try to do everything that we can to keep ourselves safe in that heinous, dangerous environment. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.